It's time for Twit. Before we get started, of course, it's Memorial Day weekend in the United States, and I want to just thank the members of our armed forces, the men and women who give so much to protect us in the United States on this Memorial Day, and those especially who have given the greatest sacrifice. Let's not forget them. We've got a great Twit ahead. Philip Elmer DeWitt, Stacey Higginbotham, and my friend Christina Warren will talk about the latest news, including Google besting Oracle for now. Teslas, you know, they can't jump. We'll find out what that means. And a whole lot more. Stay tuned. Twit is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 564, recorded Sunday, May 29th, 2016. Teslas can't jump. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Automatic, the connected car company that improves your driving and integrates your car into your digital life. For more information, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to get 20% off your purchase. And by Headspace. Train your mind for a healthier, less stressed life. Download the free Headspace app and begin their Take 10 program for 10 days of guided meditation at headspace.com/twit. And by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TWIT for 30% off your entire order. And by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/twit. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news with some of the best tech journalists in the business. We got a great panel. Oh, I'm going to have fun today. Christina Warren is here. Film girl from Mashable. Always love seeing you on the panel. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
You have behind you, your Apple TV is displaying shots of San Francisco.
Yep.
I love that. Yeah, that's really pretty. Welcome. Your microphone is way off to your right. I don't know why. Maybe you should bring that a little.
Yeah, I got it.
Oh, that's your face. Are you facing differently than you usually do?
No, I'm not. I'm good. Here
okay.
It is.
It's good. I mean, it's just I like to hear you. Fine. And yeah, there we go.
No, it's good.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Also with us, actually, it's I think it's first appearance with us since leaving Fortune Magazine, Philip Elmer DeWitt. Ped, I want to find out about the new effort.
Yeah, well,
you got a new camera. I could tell that. Man, that looks good.
It's the same camera. It's just in focus. I don't know what happened the last time.
Minor detail.
Yeah.
Minor detail. Also with us, Stacey Higginbotham, who is also our newest co-host on This Week in Google. Hello, Stacey.
Hello.
Stacey hosts an IoT podcast with Kevin Toefel. And we call her Stacey IoT, which does not mean Stacey-at.
I was going to say, it's close to Stacey Idiot. Don't do that.
Stacey-at. But also worked with, did you guys work together? I guess you did at Fortune.
We did. I think I've edited some of his stories.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And we used to sit, we sat next to each other a couple times at meetings.
I was like, you were far away. But yes, in meetings.
In meetings. Well, it's great to have two former Fortuners. And I'm not going to draw any conclusion from that.
You should.
They hired up.
Could be that.
And then they whittled down.
Could be that. Could be. We don't know.
We do.
We do know. I've been listening to Dan Lyon's book, Disrupted, on his abrupt departure from Newsweek and his attempt to make a life for himself in marketing. And it's really funny. Oh my!
The excerpts were funny. I wondered if it would hold.
It holds.
Yeah,
it holds.
He's really a funny writer. Actually, I really like his stuff.
He once said he was never as funny as he was writing fake Steve Jobs. He just never could.
Oh my God!
Do it again.
Well, that would be a tough thing to top.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I agree with him because, you know, remember he also worked for two seasons in Silicon Valley, which was one of the funniest shows on TV. What we don't know is which jokes he wrote. So right. It could be he wrote
the
bad ones.
But he was bad at Newsweek. That was
was he?
That was not good. Yeah, no, he wasn't good.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. What was bad about him?
Well, because I watch Apple. He was just wrong about Apple.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
That's not hard to do, frankly. I've been wrong about Apple many, 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 more times than I care to even think. I was the guy who said Apple is going down because they're changing to the Intel chip. Could I have been more wrong? Can't blame me for that. That seemed like a bad idea. I remember also saying, almost exactly, what was it, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Apple going into retail? Are you nuts? Don't you see what happened to Gateway?
Ooh, you fell into that.
Guess I was wrong there, too. Now I'm saying Apple. I remember saying very well when the rumor was they were going to get in the phone business, it's the last business you want to get into. That cell phone business is a terrible business.
Oh, do you make, John Gruber's got his claim chatter list. I hadn't seen your name in it.
Well, John's being kind, probably.
Oh, yeah.
The latest is, of course, why would Apple get in the car business? That's just the worst. You're trying to compete against companies that have been in this business for 100 years. Insane.
Right. Have you any idea how complicated a car is?
Exactly.
That's what they say.
Do you know how complicated it is?
Do you think they're really going to do a full-on car? I can't believe that they would do a full-on car. I feel like you got to understand how the car works before you can take it apart, and that may be what's happening. And then they just come up with platforms.
Wait a minute. You think they're like a 12-year-old kid taking apart cars? Like just to see what's inside? You think that's what's going on in those secret bunkers in Sunnyvale?
I'm gonna put it out there. I'm like, I just can't believe they would actually do a car, like a true Tesla style or car style car. Maybe something about transportation when we get to self-driving cars, I don't know. But I'm willing to be wrong.
Yeah, I think they are. I think they're building a car.
They've put a lot of money into it, right?
They have.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they've pivoted the company, and they used to make smartphones, and in the future they'll be making cars.
So you agree with that blog post that says, based on R&D numbers, it's from Above Avalon, this came out May 11th, Neil Seibert said, based on the R&D numbers and the huge growth in the R&D budget over the last few years, he said it was a pivot. I mean, a pivot implies that your current strategy has failed and have to quickly turn to another one. But in this sense, I think what he means is, just as you said, Apple's looking at a new category.
Yeah, and actually, Katie Huberty at Morgan Stanley lifted that chart, did a better job with it. And Morgan Stanley came out and said, yeah, they're doing it. They basically did for the buy side investors what Above Avalon did for ordinary mortals.
Well, what
you should, you should put my new blog address.
We'll put that in. I'm sorry we didn't check your lower third before. Yeah. What is the new blog?
Well, it's called Apple 3.0, and the address is ped30.com.
And Philip, I should point out, has a much better track record of Apple prognostication than I do. I also, as long as we're being complete, said the Apple Watch would be a flop, and I love the Newton.
Right. Well, I'm just more cautious than you are. I try not to say what's going to happen. I wait till it happens.
It's a dumb thing to predict tech.
It's dangerous to bet against Apple.
It doesn't feel like it's dangerous these days.
Well, it depends whether you're talking about short-term bets in the in the options markets, or whether you're talking about, everybody says Apple, the iPhone, well, you just said it, the iPhone, business is dying, so they have to pivot to cars. Well, ask all of Apple's competitors whether they think the iPhone business is dying.
The stock market seems to be believers. Apple tanked a little bit when the quarterly results came out and they showed that they weren't, in fact, growing the iPhone market. But now, they're up about 10% over the last few days.
Yeah, that's...
What's that? Is that profit? Well, is that people...
No, it's Warren Buffett.
Oh, Warren Buffett. Must be nice. Oh, yeah, that's Warren.
That just, It's not just him. He actually bought it last quarter. And it wasn't even him. It was Berkshire Hathaway.
He's quick to point out it wasn't him at all. He says, I only weigh in on buys more than $1 billion. It was one of his managers who spent $950 million. And I have to think the guy's sitting there saying, well, stop. You spent a little bit more. We're going to have to call Warren. Let's stop at 950.
But this, you know, the last couple of weeks, the stock is, it hit bottom and bounced finally. And it's not Warren Buffett or even Berkshire Hathaway. That's old news. What it is the value investors seeing they do what Berkshire Hathaway does. So the money's been moving. And also Apple, which wasn't buying back shares for a while, is now buying back shares again. And
that may be more important to those investors, the fact that they probably can profit. Yeah. Well, sell it back.
Berkshire Hathaway put in $1 billion. Apple just increased the amount it's going to spend on buybacks by $35 billion to give you a sense of the scale of things.
Well, and also to give you a sense, and this is not a stock market show, and I'd be the last person to listen to any stock tips from me.
From me.
or you. We wouldn't be journalists if we knew anything about the stock market. We'd be out there driving our Bugattis. But I look at Apple's and I think that's what people are looking for if they're value investors, is a stock price that is that is below what it should be. And I look at Apple's price to earning. They're $11, $11.17 PDE.
That's before you take the cash out.
That's
the cash. It's more like $8.
And Amazon, what is Amazon's PDE? It's like $8 billion or something.
It's usually you can't chart it because it's infinity. But it's come down, and now it's like a 200 and something now.
Unbelievable. So, and at the same time, I'd feel better buying Amazon stock maybe now than Apple. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it's all based on what people think it's going to grow.
Right.
And Amazon and Google are growing like gangbusters, and Apple just had its first down quarter in 13 years. So that explains.
But for our purposes, I mean, we're not talking about what you should buy or anything like that. What we're, stock wise, we're talking about how companies are doing, what their future is, and whether they're going to change their business because they have to. Amazon's PDE right now is $293 compared to Apple's $11.
If you look at Apple, Joe is just selling physical goods, which is kind of how people tend to see them, And you look at Amazon, which is in distribution, it is in e-commerce, it is now banking on kind of AI with the Echo. That's a lot.
The cloud.
And the $10 billion cloud business, right?
Yeah. It's a big business for them, even though they suck at it.
I don't think they suck at it.
Really, Christina? You think they've done a good job with their services?
I do. I think AWS has been a huge success.
You're talking about Amazon. I was talking about Apple.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. stay with the thread. I'm sorry. Hey, can you boost Christina's volume up? She's not as loud as the rest of us. You must have had some sense, though, Philip, what we were going to talk about, because I look at the blog post you wrote, I presume earlier, tonight on Twit, Apple is doomed.
Yeah. Well, I just knew that it was going to come up.
You knew this would come up.
Yeah. And, I forgot the little slash S or whatever one says when one's being ironic.
Yeah. You know, that's not going to work. People don't understand irony on the internet. I would be the last person to say any company with $200 billion in cash in the bank is doomed.
Yeah, you have to subtract the $80 billion that they borrowed to give back to shareholders. It's about, it's $240 and then you minus $80, so it's like
$160 billion. Sorry.
Only $160 billion. It's like bigger than the GDP of how many countries combined?
I loved, as long as we're talking Apple, I loved this Bolts blog. I've actually bookmarked this because I thought it was so great. This is on Medium. Ben Einstein, product designer, lover of hardware, founder and partner at Bolt VC. It's a venture capitalist. No, you can't manufacture that like Apple does. Too many startups, he says, look at Apple's manufacturing and say, I want to do it like that. I want laser drilled holes. I don't want to see any mold marks on my plastics. I want to make a white plastic device. And he says, you can't. Just give up on it. Here are a few things Apple does that can cause problems for a startup. White plastic. It's the hardest color to do. Even Apple had a hard time with, I think it was, what was it? It was a white MacBook or something. They had to, they had to put it off because they couldn't get the parts to match.
But you know what and they do and the to white fix
iPhone.
That?
White
iPhone, that's what it was, yeah. Right.
You can a lot. You'll see this if you look at your products that are white. They do a shiny finish on one spot, and where the joins are, they do a matte finish. And then they're like, "Oh, we chose this because it's like water. It's smooth." And then we went with this more granular, gritty finish. I'm like, "Yeah, huh?"
They said, "Don't do CNC. Expect to do it at Apple scale." What happened when Apple wanted to see the CNC machines? A million MacBook bodies, those aluminum bodies, they bought 10,000 CNC machines to do it. When they
computerized numerical controller or something like
that? Yes, those automated whatever machines. I don't even
It's automated milling. It goes through.
Thank you. That's the word.
Yep.
How about when they wanted to laser drill holes in MacBook Pros for the sleep light, but only one company made a machine that could drill those 20 micrometer holes in aluminum, so they bought the company.
Why not? It makes sense.
That's what you do when you have $140 billion in cash.
Exactly.
You know, the one that got me, though, because I look at Apple boxes I'm the guy who does the recycling in the house, and every Monday I have to break down all the boxes, and there are a ton of boxes that I have to break. I spend an hour every Monday night breaking down boxes for the recycling, and it's always the Apple boxes that you almost feel like, I'm destroying a work of art here.
Completely. Do you remember the original iPod box that was origami?
No, I don't.
I loved that box. Oh. So the original iPod box would kind of fold out in different ways, and it had kind of like overlapping things. It was a square, and you had to fold it in a certain way. It was like an origami piece. It was so great. And, I remember I kept that box for years, even after I got rid of that original iPod, just because the box was so fantastic.
Ben writes,
a basement full of boxes.
Yeah, you don't want to throw them out. Look at this. Yeah. This is the Apple Watch box. The squares, it's like you used a CNC machine on the cardboard. This is perfect, perfect squares. And, of course, it's a vacuum, right? So you can't just pull the lid off. It's tight, so tight that it's a vacuum. And then the foam inserts, he says, Ben writes, four-color, doubled-walled matte boxes and HD foam inserts. I know you're going to do this anyway. But be aware, these kinds of boxes will literally be the most expensive line item on your build of materials. It's not unusual for them to cost upwards of $12 a unit at scale.
Oh, my God. They spend something like $3 for those rows of Chinese workers to assemble them.
Right. But the box, you're assembling a box that costs more than you do per hour. Look at this. And then I break them down because I'm not going to keep this. But I feel terrible doing it. I feel like I should feed this to a starving child in Ethiopia or something. That's bad. I should not say that.
People actually make money making those unboxing YouTubes.
Oh, yeah.
Get 100,000 hits.
We just you saw me unbox my 43-inch monitor. that was not boxed quite as tidily.
What are you going to see on your four screens?
I don't know. I have no use for it, but I thought it's sometimes this tech stuff can really get you in trouble. That's all. That's all I'm saying. Just have a Jones. All right. There's a lot of Mac stuff, but somebody in the chat room is pointing out, quite rightly so, that Apple is the Donald Trump of the tech journalist. It's the one it's the third rail we can't stop touching.
That's what a horrible thing to say.
That's a terrible analogy.
It's true, though, isn't it?
No, because Donald Trump is awful.
Well, I'm sure there are plenty of people who think another Apple story, really, Leo?
Oh, that's me.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. Stacey? We can talk about something else. I'm happy to do that.
I can join with something else. I was going to say that I found something that my Tesla won't do, which if anyone in your chat room has any idea how to do this, it can't jump a car.
Wait a minute. You tried to jump a car in your Tesla?
I didn't try to jump a car, but we realized we couldn't. And I know there's a 12-volt battery on it somewhere.
Oh, jump start it. Oh, you're right. Yeah. You can't. No.
So this was something we just learned today because my daughter left the car door open. And so my husband's car, his battery died. And we're like, oh, and then.
Isn't that ironic? Oh, I happen to have a 25,000 watt battery pack right here.
Right.
But I can't start your car.
So, yeah, that, if anyone has suggestions, I am here for them.
Well, am I the only person who thought what she meant was jumping her car over other cars?
No, I thought that too. I thought that too. But but in fairness to me, I don't drive.
No, I drive and I still thought.
I like that you have that visual of me. Like, I go and do that. I'm like, yes. Evil.
So you have a Tesla. You have a Model S?
I do have a Model S.
How do you like it?
I love it. It's not the fancy. I bought it used. Because I am not crazy and I buy all my cars used.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have the autopilot features, which kind of makes me sad. But I'm because I still love
the car. I'm thinking you're probably better off.
After seeing all the stories about, I'm going to summon my car into another car, I'm happy about that.
You know, what I find interesting, of course, there's at least two people now who say that the autopilot has driven me into something, caused a wreck or whatever. And in each case, Tesla's response is, well, we happen to have the data from everything you've done, and you could see you made an error here.
Yep.
And it's like, what?
You're basically going to end up arguing with the computer.
They know everywhere. They apparently have every bit of everything I do is being logged in your Tesla.
Well, that's what happened to that New York Times reporter who tried to drive from Washington to New York or something and ran out of juice. And Elon Musk actually personally said, wait a minute, I'm looking at your record. Why'd you go here? Why'd you go there? Why didn't you go where you're supposed to go?
Does that not bother people?
It's something I think about, actually, whenever I review like a connected device. I am super hyper conscious of like taking notes, videoing things, because I know that if I get something wrong, just by virtue of human error, and it could be something really trivial, all the data on, I mean, in some ways it's accuracy, but in other ways it's really disconcerting.
This is a different era. I don't think there's any precedent for a consumer product phoning home and telling the company that made it what you're doing with it. That's never been possible before.
Well, and Tesla doesn't always give the data. There was a guy in Norway who wanted to use his Tesla data to fight a parking ticket, or I think it was a parking ticket.
And they won't tell him.
And they wouldn't give it to him. They were like, nope.
Oh, no, it's ours.
He had written a nasty review.
Yeah.
Then he could have gotten it.
Holy cow. I mean, I think people thought it was bad that Apple could look at a test strip in your phone and say, tell you got it wet. This goes far beyond that.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry, you seem to have dropped your phone in the toilet on 43rd and Broadway. About 4:30 a.m., you were in a men's room. Do you want to talk about that? Oh, no, it's not. Never mind. I'll take it home. It's fine. I don't want to talk about that. And yet we live in this era where people are so concerned about privacy. I guess if you're a Tesla owner, you just accept that that's the price you pay to own a Tesla.
Speaking of the price you pay, can't you get Tesla to come start your car for you?
Yeah. No, not that car. That's the problem. It was the other car.
The car next to the Tesla.
Oh,
just proximity to a Tesla does not guarantee
a
jump.
Tesla's not going to come and start this for the old car.
You know, I had to get a hybrid, not a Prius, but made by Toyota. I forget the name. Started because someone had left the light on for a week in a airport parking garage. And two things are weird. One, this car has a huge battery in it, but it can't be used to start the car.
It's exactly. That's what she's saying.
To start its own car. It can't start. Yeah.
Wait a minute. They can't use the battery in the hybrid to start the starter?
No, because the starter runs on a separate battery. And when that one goes dead, they could, but they haven't connected the two batteries. The second thing is when the guy came to open it up, neither of us had a manual, and it was really quite tricky finding where the plus and minus were. They're not big red buttons with junk all over them. They're under little things you have to flip up, and then they don't look like the normal things. They look like USB ports, sort of. So it was a whole new world.
you wrote an article on pivoting from smartphones to smart cars, in which apparently a car is jumping another car. So
that was VW saying we're going to bury Apple.
Oh,
it was
Lord.
Also Horace Desdoux saying that that when Apple gets into it, they're not going to make 50,000 units like Tesla. They're going to make 2 million units a year.
Isn't that what Elon Musk kind of said is, look, we're going to jumpstart this industry, but ultimately we want it to be a mass market, whether it's us or somebody else.
Well, yeah, but he needs it to be, of course. Yeah. Now, will it be? I think that's a much different question. Because I don't know if they can get the scale that's necessary.
Well,
you know, they're getting pushback.
And there's the Bolt, Chevy Bolt, which is a $30,000 all-electric vehicle with similar range to a Tesla. And Chevy seems to have some expertise in car manufacture.
Yeah, I drove one of those Volts.
What do you, the new one? Yeah. The Bolt? Not the Volt. No,
I drove the previous one. It didn't have the sufficient range. You can't live...
No, that's the new one. See, that's the thing. So the Volt has a little gas engine, little generator. I shouldn't call it an engine, a generator in it to charge the battery. The Bolt is all electric, and they say they're going to have a couple hundred miles range, don't they?
I thought it was was it 165?
Okay, in the ballpark. Your mileage may vary. But that's significantly more than the current crop.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's still not very, because it all depends on how you drive. So,
right.
Mine's rated for, 265?
Right.
But you don't charge
temperature. What what are you getting?
Also, age of the battery changes too. You lose mileage.
Yeah.
They're saying estimated more than 200 miles of range on the all-electric Chevy Bolt EV.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Yeah. I get about 200 when I drive.
That's enough?
Well, yeah.
Depends where you're going and what's at the other end. Yeah. Yeah, I guess you would be nervous, right? Because it's not like you can call AAA and say, bring me a gallon of electricity.
Right. No, I mean, I desperately want my mom to get a Tesla. And that's always her fear. They live in the suburbs of Atlanta, and there are some stations in Atlanta proper, but they're 40 miles away from their house. And so, if they're driving a lot, I'm like, yeah, you know what? This would probably not work for the distances you drive. You would probably frequently be freaking out about, am I going to make it to get charged
up?
It's
not for everybody.
Which I think that's the biggest thing, that even beyond the mass production that has to be solved, right, is making it so that there are charging stations that are accessible everywhere so that people can, pop in and charge up.
And, of course, that's what Elon Musk tried to solve with the superchargers. They're free fill-ups for Teslas, but they have to be near you.
Yeah, and they have to be near you, and there's only, the one between our, Austin and Houston that we stop at. I think it's got six little
plugs.
Parking spots.
Yeah.
Plugs, that's it. and it's fine most of the time, but during a busy travel weekend, it might get kind of full. And then the other thing is, once the Houston floods happened, it was flooded.
Ooh.
And I'm still not sure if it's ready, but before we take the Tesla down to Houston, we've got to check.
Yeah. It's complicated, I guess.
It's an extra thing to think about.
You probably still want to have a gasoline powered car for the time being.
And jumper cables.
And jumper cables and a nice neighbor.
And nice neighbor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're at the early stages of a transition.
Yes.
And, 5 years from now, we'll look back and say, those problems were that hard to solve.
You think? Because sometimes they are hard to solve. And five years from now, we may look back and say, what were we thinking?
Well, in this case, we're talking about putting up charging stations roughly where you have gas stations now.
It's more than that, because how long does it take? Even at the supercharger, you have to sit there a couple hours, right?
That is a problem.
No, the supercharger is about 20 minutes
for 80%. It's that last 20 that takes the other hour and a half.
It doesn't take a full... I mean, we've gotten it almost all the way up in about 35 or
40. That's not bad. But that's a supercharger. And in fact, Tesla says don't use that too often because it's kind of more for in fact, they told me I can't use the supercharger in Petaluma because I live here.
Right.
It's not intended for you. It's not like you have a free gas tank you should go over every day and fill up at.
It's the model of the iPhone. You got to plug it in every night.
It's true.
Well, yeah, I got a special plug put in my garage. No Tesla, but I got the plug. Someday,
halfway
maybe.
There?
Halfway
you're
there.
Not Quart- even
about
180th.
Of the way there? Yeah, 1,000th of the way there. Let's talk about. Well, actually, let's take a break and then talk about Google Oracle. We can also. There's lots to talk about. I have many a topic on our list here, but I also want to defer to you guys because it's always fun. We get people on the show, and it's Stacy's first or second time on the show. It's Phillip's. He's been several times, and Christina's a regular. But it's always fun to let you guys choose what you want to talk about. So I'll open it up to you in a second. Meanwhile, as long as we're talking about car tech, I want to talk about something you can do with your car, any car made since 1996. And that's this. This is the automatic. This is so cool. So every car in the United States, and I think all over the world, made since 1996, has a port underneath the steering wheel you probably never noticed called the onboard diagnostic port, or OBD2. And, you know, if you do notice it, you think, oh, yeah, that's when I take it into the shop. They're going to plug in their computer. Well, did you know you can plug in your own device? This is the automatic. Plugs right into it. Easy to do. There's no tools or anything. It just snaps right in there. And then you pair it to your phone with Bluetooth, iPhone or Android, and suddenly you know what's going on inside your car. Everything from what is that light, that just warning light that just come on mean, and where's the nearest gas station or repair shop to I take it to how hot your engine is, how fast it's revving, how much gas you've used, how much that last trip cost you. Because the automatic also knows what gasoline costs at the gas station you used last, so they know exactly how much it costs. You can ask your, if you have an Amazon Echo, you can say to the Echo, hey, ask my automatic how much gas is in the tank. Oh, you have half a tank left. Oh, thank you. It'll work with not just your Echo, your Nest software like Your Mechanic. It'll work with FreshBooks if you want to track mileage for business. If this, then that. I use it all the time with if this and that. I have an if this and that script that when I pull up to the studio, tweets, hey, Leo just pulled up. Let's get something going. It'd be just as good for your teenagers if you wanted to keep an eye on them. There's even a 24/7 crash response feature, which helps you know that automatic's keeping your loved ones safe on the road at all times. They have software for teenagers, too, that ties in with the automatic. Works with the Apple Watch and Pebble, too. And best of all, you might look at this and say, wow. How much a month? Nothing. There's no subscription fee. No, nothing. It's $99, and that's it. And we're going to make it even more affordable because, and by the way, they never sell your data. Your data is yours. If you go to automatic.com/twit, you're going to get 20% off when you use the offer code TWIT at checkout. I love my automatic. I just love knowing, you know, I kind of play a game with it, see how, if I can get a good score. You know, oh, you got 80% driving to work today. I try to get 90% next time. And that just means you're getting better mileage and you're a safer driver. I love it. Automatic.com/twit. 20% off when you use the offer code TWIT at checkout. Philip Elmer DeWitt is here. PED 3.0. Not 2.0. 3.0. PED 30.
Uh-oh. At business 2.0. And,
oh, I get
and
it.
I call that Apple 2.0. And then now I'm, you know, read into it what you want. Anyway, it's been fun. I tell you, it's just so great to be on my own and not having to worry about fortune. Can you hear me?
Tell me about it. Yeah, we're listening. Well, we're just in awe of you, Philip.
Well, I think we talked about this before. You know, when I started doing this stuff for Fortune, it was me and a couple other people, and they really weren't paying attention. But after the spinoff, after Time Warner let Time Inc. go with
they sat up and started paying attention.
Well, they realized they had to make money on it.
So
they got into the same business that every legacy media is in now. And it's like, it feels like a death spiral where they have to get more and more ads. They're basically trading, you know, print ad dollars for internet pennies, and they're discovering that they have to pump a lot of ads past a lot of eyeballs to make what they used to make, you know, on dead trees. And it's a tough business. And what they did at Fortune is they staffed up. They got some really good people, Stacy and a bunch of others from GigaOM. But they also hired a bunch of kids and put them in a kind of a bullpen in something they called the SEO Speedwagon for search engine optimization. And it's kind of like the Huffington Postization of Fortune magazine, where they, you know, they're going for the stuff that gets clicks.
It's what everybody's doing now, though. Right. It's really right. Kind of, in some ways, I feel so, it feels like the death knell of journalism, this clickbait journalism.
Yeah, well, we'll get to Gawker.
Oh, let's talk about Gawker.
Well, we can get there in a second, but just my particular thing was that these kids were chasing Apple stories, which I would too if I were them. So I get up in the morning and think, okay, what am I going to write about today? And one after another, the subjects that I was going to do, one of the guys had already claimed. And so I was navigating this. Every time I had to pick a topic, I had to navigate this thing. Anyway, so it's so great.
It's not so bad to have competition among your writers, is it? I mean, I think that seems like a good idea.
Well, it was a little crowded. It's good to have competition, but I'm competing already with 100 other people who write about
That's
Apple every day. And I didn't need to compete with my own team.
Yeah.
So they basically, you know... I think we talked about this. They said, okay, you can't just write about Apple anymore. You got to broaden your scope. And for me, you know, it took a long time to build a reputation as someone who covers Apple. And it was just, it was like walking away from my niche. It didn't make sense.
Right.
So I did what I had been talking about doing for a long time, which is going off on my own, which Stacy has also done, and a lot of other people, the Ben Thompsons of the world, the John Gruber is the classic example.
Was Gruber, though, a journalist before? I mean,
no.
No, he was a developer. No.
Yeah.
Jason Snell. Right.
Snell was a journalist, and he's gone his own way with sixcolors.com.
Right.
Stacy has done that, too. She's doing the Stacy on IoT.
Yeah.
And I did I mean, I still keep my foot in the mainstream waters with a radio show, but really Twit for 10 years now, the main reason I did it was because I didn't want to, it wasn't so much I saw the writing on the wall, it was more like I just didn't want some idiot to tell me what to do, and I also didn't want to have to work hard as we did at Tech TV for 6 years so that some guy could just say, I'm tired of this, and sell it. You don't own your own destiny when you work for somebody, and so but at the same time, come on, admit it, it's kind of scary doing what we're doing.
Oh, it's hard.
Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough that I socked away enough money working for Time Inc. for decades.
So you have a safety net.
I've got like a long runway. But here's what...
that's why I still do radio, by the way. That's my safety net. And whenever I go by a McDonald's and I see a help wanted sign, I make a note of that.
Mine is Starbucks.
It sounds like a joke, but it's real, isn't it, Stacey?
I am so like...
Were you a barista? Did you work at a...
But I could be.
Yeah.
I have a lot of faith in
I always keep that in mind. When I see a help wanted, I think, well, okay, just in case, let's keep, you know, because I worked at McDonald's for years and I know how to flip a burger like no one.
Well, two things I've discovered, and then I'll stop on me and we can talk about something else, well, I've forgotten one of them. The other is, one is that owning your email, owning the emails of the people that are subscribing to you is what it's all about. And that's so.
That's why Verizon wants to buy Yahoo if you kind of expand that beyond just emails.
The other thing is I didn't realize how much I'd care about my readers.
Yeah, interesting.
These guys who send me $10 every month, and the guys, God bless them, who put $100 in. I love these guys.
Yeah.
I love them. I love getting the money. I love that they're sticking around. It's just been a wonderful experience.
I'm kind of – that's actually the more genuine reason to do this is to because you know your audience is not being served by the way things are working, and you see an opportunity to serve them properly. That if you say it that way, it sounds better.
There you go.
Yeah.
What did you
say? I used to have people call me up after I'd file stories and they'd be like, Stacy, and asking me all these follow up questions. And I'm like, dang, I know the answers to this.
Right.
I should just really give it to them.
Right.
But efficiently.
Right.
Not on one on one conversations.
Yeah.
Right.
So
good. And, you know, to some degree, there's been some disappointment in, I think, what the internet has become. I think a lot of us at the beginning thought, oh, this is going to be this amazing force for democratization. Everybody's going to get a voice. The oligarchs, the plutocrats who controlled media will be disenfranchised. It's going to be ultimately democratic. information will flow freely. And all of that did happen. But what we maybe didn't anticipate is what a problem it would cause, what a disruption it would be for the old media in such a way that so many traditional and useful things disappeared. And so we lost as much as we gained. And I don't know. Christina Warren, you're a child of the internet.
Yeah.
And you're internet native. Mashable is, you know, the king of internet native. Do you look back and feel that we've lost anything?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. I mean, it's weird because I remember when I started writing professionally, I specifically chose to do web rather than print. I started off kind of doing both, and I made the decision to do web versus print because I felt like that was the future. And I was fortunate enough that when I started writing, you could still kind of make a name for yourself online, because even though it was the mid-2000s, the legacy media still was, you know, down on blogs and didn't really understand that this was where everything was going. But it became very clear once everything started moving from print to digital that the establishment was not going to be willing to give up what was there. And I do feel like we've lost certain things. I mean, you look at all the great newspapers that have closed, you know, and great journalism that goes away, and that's really disappointing. But then you even look at, you know, websites and that have come and gone over the years. And so, I mean, I think media is just hard. I think that's this kind of the long and the short of it. There used to be a business model that works differently. And there used to be kind of a, you know, people who would fund media for different purposes that doesn't quite exist anymore. And
we'd gain more than we lost, though. I thought, and this, I'm starting to get a little discouraged by the state. For instance, the idea that there could be 1,000 blogs covering Apple.
Yeah.
And all the different angles and facts would come out, and we'd, as users, as consumers, we'd have more information and be more informed.
Well, I think the problem, though, is that obviously you can do that, but that doesn't really... But at a certain point, you want to get the best content.
Well, they're all chasing each other now. You read one story, and it's the same, you know, 18 blogs report exactly the same story.
Totally. Well, I mean, I think that it comes down to, at least with certain industries, especially with kind of business and tech journalism, there aren't as many interesting stories to tell, if we're being totally honest. I mean, there might be, you could always argue, oh, well, there's things that are being unreported, uncovered. Okay, fine, then cover that. But there are things that people are interested in, and you are chasing eyeballs. You're wanting to get what people want. And the truth of the matter is that there's kind of this, you know, middle 80%, you know, in kind of your bell curve stuff of stuff that people want to read about. And
so everybody's going to write that stuff.
Everybody's going to write that. And the thing is, at that point, you have 1,000 different sources, but you're all competing for one another. And the biggest ones are going to be the ones that succeed.
But you could add something. I mean, we cover the same stories everybody else does, but we try to add value with context.
Totally.
With intelligent
people. And I think the people who do well with it either add something or they get there really early, you know, I mean, but it's difficult.
Yeah, we don't break stories. So we know we can't. So we can do is take somebody else's story and make it more, you know.
But I do wonder even like how different this is. And you guys would have to like let me know, because I mean, I would know this maybe a little bit as a news reader, but I don't know this as from any professional experience or any personal experience. But how different is it from, you know, the era when there might be, you know, X or, you know, 3 or 4 local newspapers, as Ken from Chicago is saying in chat? You know, I mean, I remember when in Atlanta there was both the Journal and the Constitution, and then they merged. And you have to wonder, you know, weren't they just chasing one another to re-report the exact same things and fight for the same stories? And so I wonder how much of it is feeling nostalgic for a time long past that wasn't that different than where we are now. You know, if you had a bunch of local newspapers that were basically writing the same stories.
Is it just nostalgia for a past that never existed?
No, I think there was a little bit more room for smaller stories or... Actually, okay, no, I'm going to change my mind.
It's just bullshit. It's all nostalgic bullshit.
No. I think of it as sort of the best of times and the worst of times. It really has democratized media. In the old saying,
you look at YouTube, everybody can make a video. Anybody can write a blog.
Yeah, but look at who's successful on YouTube.
Yeah.
Again, look at who's successful on YouTube.
But I mean, Philip, if he said, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm going to create my own blog. Now it's going to be rough going. You have to win an audience. You have to create a brand. I mean, you know, there's a lot of work to that, but there's the opportunity to do it.
Sure.
You don't have to go hat in hand to William Randolph Hearst and say, please, sir, can I borrow some ink?
Well, it is the worst of times in that there's a generation of journalists who are out of a job, and there's
I feel bad about that. Yeah.
And there's, you know, newspapers across the country that have folded. It's mostly the work of Craigslist because the dirty secret was these newspapers were being funded by legal ads help wanted ads, classifieds. It has created huge opportunities. What I'm disappointed, you know, that anybody can now own a press and enjoy freedom of the press. But I'm disappointed in how it's turned out. I think the echo chamber is a real and worthless thing. That 9 to 5 Mac will get some scoop, and it will be, you know, it'll be embarrassing. There'll be, you know, 45 stories about it the next morning, adding very little value because they've learned that pays. They can just repurpose a 9 to 5 Mac scoop in 3 paragraphs, and they'll sell enough ads that it justifies it. But it's not taking journalism anywhere good. And the question really that remains is, who is going to pay for the reporting? You know, in the old days, I worked for a magazine that used to have bureaus in Bangkok and Hong Kong and Baghdad and Paris, and every major city in the world had a Time magazine correspondent in there or stringers who could be counted on to deliver reporting whenever needed. Those bureaus have almost all been closed, along with the bureaus that were, you know, for the LA Times and the Boston Globe and the smaller major newspapers. And now we have the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal are the only really serious national newspapers in the U.S. And we have USA Today for the hotel rooms. And it's not... It isn't like it used to be. Now, some of those were killed off by television, and you know, some of them were killed off by radio, but nothing like the damage that happened when the internet disrupted and pulled the rug out from under their business model. So it remains to be seen. I think there's great stuff being done on the internet, I won't hurt anybody's feelings by naming names, but I think the people who know that they're doing good work know it, and the people who are doing schlock page click stuff know it as well, and we can only hope that the market rewards the people who are doing good work. Now, you know, and now maybe is where we talk about Gawker, because it is probably
well, we interrupted you. You had changed your mind, but we didn't find out what you changed your mind to.
Oh, I was going to change. I was changing my mind to say that I think the business model, the opportunity is still there. I think what people are confused about is how to match that to the right business model. And if you can, like, what I'm doing is probably never going to be a massive media empire, right? So as long as I can keep it up, I can make a living wage for myself.
Haven't we seen this, though, now? Okay, I'll use an example of the music industry, where it was ruled by a handful of multi-platinum artists who took all the money out of the ecosystem. But now we in such a different world where you're not going to get maybe as many multi-platinum artists, but many more musicians can make a living. And isn't that a better situation?
Except I don't think that's happened for the music industry. Oh. I think the music industry, you have like 3 artists. You have like Adele, you have Taylor Swift, you have Beyonce.
It's now just
and
fewer.
They make the money.
Yeah.
It's fewer. Well, what they've had to do is they've had to shift and go. There was a period of time about 20, 30 years where you could actually make a lot of money selling music. That has changed. That is no longer the case since Napster and since the music industry.
I mean, you're not having AC/DC selling 100 million albums. That's just
no, but you have, but you still have them touring, and that's where they make money. Shifted too. So it's become
the long-term opportunity, though, of Spotify and the new music ecosystem is that more bands can make a little money. They're not making any money.
Artists I've talked to, exactly. I mean, you have those breakout successes.
It's all in performing.
You know, it is. You have those bands who happen to get really high.
All right.
On the Spotify.
I shouldn't have used the music industry then, maybe.
Well, the music industry. But I think it actually makes a lot of sense with newspapers and with traditional media in general. In that, I think in both cases they were disrupted, and it wasn't so much that there wasn't an opportunity for them to fight the disruption; it's that they refused.
Right.
You know, you look at legacy media, and I look at it and I go, well, obviously Craigslist was able to.
Part
kind
of the problem is though that we
didn't fight back.
We're in the middle of a transition, so it's hard to say where we're headed. Certainly, what we can see is disruption, But I think in the, you know, maybe 10 years out, if you're an artist, what you're going to say is, I'm not going to sign with a label.
Right.
I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to have a website. I'm going to sell music directly to the fans. I'm going to build a community that supports me, not because they have to buy my music, because they don't. They can steal it. But because they want to support me by buying my music, they'll come to my shows. And that kind of artist, and I think that there are artists now already starting to do that. More and more that's going to exist. Will in the
Radiohead
long run.
Did it with their album.
Yeah. I think of Jonathan Colton and Humphries McGee. I think a lot of unsigned groups who are going around now are making a decent living. They're not going to sell 100 million albums, but they're making a decent living. And so I only bring this up as a kind of a metaphor for what democratization could ultimately be, which is fewer people get really rich, but there's a broader base for journalists like Stacey and you, Philip, and me to make a living doing what we want to do, serving an audience directly. And that's the key, by the way, is that direct relation. I think the direct relationship with the audience. So the audience wants to support you by patronizing you.
Maybe. You do have to give up a lot of yourself in a way that's not, I mean, I never wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I think that is something that's
not everybody can do that. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, A, it costs money. B, it requires a certain mentality. And
well,
I'm
lucky, you know what? Because there are a lot of artists who are space cadets who aren't going to do this.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so
right.
Those people relied on the music label to do all the work so they could just kind of space out. Those, you know, it's going to be the musicians, the journalists, the plumbers who can create a business and understand the need to build an audience and a community that will succeed. So it's not just that one skill anymore, being able to play a guitar. Okay, I don't see that as the worst thing in the world. I do worry about those people who have that single skill. But
well,
maybe kids growing
really
up today
awesome.
Will understand that.
I was going to say, what does that say for art, where art now is undervalued to the point where
Picasso
you have to be-
was a businessman. You know what?
Sure.
I don't know if he was a better painter than Van Gogh, but he made a hell of a lot more money.
But that's your point. But Van Gogh wasn't. You know, he had people who would, I mean, and he kind of died poor, but I mean, he had people supporting him. But, you know, you look at
if it
at,
weren't for
you
his
know,
brother,
Matisse.
He would have died earlier, and he still
right.
died young and poor, and then his art was worth a huge amount of money. Picasso didn't want to become a Van Gogh and was a very good businessman.
Which is fair, but I feel like I worry sometimes we move into that place where we now prioritize
right.
Business.
Basquiat
over,
is about being a good businessman, not being a great artist.
Well, right. In journalism, the skills that make for a good journalist are not the same skills that make for a good publisher.
Well, they never are. And the same thing with a musician, right?
Well, I have no idea about being a musician, but I mean, I'm an abrasive, abrupt, kind of awkward person sometimes, and I don't always answer my email, which is why, you know, someone else does all my advertising because...
Well, that's what I did too. I hired somebody else.
See, so I mean, but that's an expense. So it's, I don't
it's
know.
I think it's an interesting world. I'm going to say something very controversial, and I may not even fully believe it. But I think of Andrew Sullivan's article about the America has never been more ripe for an authoritarian government. And his contention is that it was the elites protecting us. And I'll extend this to journalism, that what we lost with the democratization was this sense that, and think about network news. Edward R. Murrow created a brilliant news organization at CBS. Mm-hmm. Even though that was going to be a money loser because it was prestigious and the elites
right.
were interested in creating a prestigious, important thing and making money, you know, putting commerce in a different realm. But the problem is when it's a bunch of us little guys and we all have to make a living, it's democratized. We can't do that. We can't say we're going to do this because it's important, because it's right, not because it makes money.
Right. I mean, that's where you have things like First Look Media and people like Pierre Omidyar, who I think are doing interesting things and are potentially trying to kind of bring that back. But you're
but
right.
That's back to the plutocrat, right? The rich guy.
It is. Right. Which, I mean, I'm not saying that that needs to be the model because I don't think it scales and I don't think it works. But I'm not opposed to it existing if it means good work can still be done.
I feel like, and maybe it's because I am an elite. You know, I went to the best schools and blah, 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 and I'm white male and, you know, and I'm a media elite, that losing the media elite, losing the elite in any area is a loss.
Well, are you talking about the publishers or the editors?
Well, it took both, right? The publishers had to say, look, we're going to willing to do some stuff that loses money as long as we can build a business that makes money, because it's right. It's right to cover. You know, CNN has closed all its international bureaus, right? Even Vice now just closed its London bureau. You know, these things are expensive. You do them not to make money. You do them because it's the right thing to do. And you can only do that, frankly, maybe you can only do that when you have a plutocrat who says, well, I'm willing to spend money on the Washington Post. I'm willing to spend some of my Amazon billions on the Washington Post because it's the right thing to do rather than the profitable thing to do. Should profit drive journalism?
So I feel like not every journalistic organization obviously was started by someone who was an elite searching for the right thing to do. Usually, if you like look at Sheldon Adelson. Adelson.
Yeah. He was a plutocrat first and a media mogul later.
And then, right. You know,
And what is he seeking is not, he's not seeking the right thing to do. He's seeking power.
Right. And you, I mean, you could look at like Hearst and
same thing.
So yeah. I think that's one aspect of it. Two, I think the quote unquote elite, people who have money, people who have the freedom and privilege to spend time not worrying about survival and like you can, I mean, you can afford morality. You can afford time to think and develop ideals.
Morality, that's right. It's at the top of Maslow's pyramid, right? If you're busy surviving, you don't get to be actualized. That's later.
So, I mean,
I mean, the history of the press is a lot of rich lords and stuff who decided on a whim to start a newspaper. They're often the best ones are often family owned. I mean, the New York Times family keeps it alive.
Washington Post for years.
Right. Oh, the interesting example is the Herald Tribune, which was a better newspaper in many ways, but the family at some point stopped caring about it and they just kept taking money out of it. And just before World War II, when the New York Times was pouring money back into the operation and setting up these bureaus in Europe, the Tribune was closing down bureaus. And when World War II hit, the Times had people on the ground ready to report the biggest story of the decade of the century, and the Tribune didn't, and it died. They blamed their death on the unions, but it was really that they stopped paying for the reporting. Now it's a different group of guys now, the plutocrats, that you're referring to, I guess the internet billionaires. And what we learn is that they can save newspapers like the Washington Post by buying it with Amazon funny money. Or they can close down an operation by tying it up in lawsuits.
Yeah. Or Chris Hughes with the New Republic, where it was just a toy for him.
That was
trashed a great magazine, although some have said, nah, it hadn't been great for years.
Well, but
he trashed a great magazine and then said, got tired of it and sold it.
Completely. Well, he went in again, I think, buying it for that prestige.
Right.
Frankly, because I remember speaking with him when he bought it, and you very much got the sense that he
was a Facebook founder and had lots of money.
Yes, and he very much got the sense that, you know, this would be yet another thing to add to, you know, his,
it was a toy.
His, you know, exactly. And then it realized, oh, wait, this is actually a really complicated situation. This is a brand that has been through a lot, that's already been kind of damaged and has been suffering. Then there's, you know, he tries to bring in some new leadership and ends up, you know, having a mass staff exodus because that didn't work and never does. And then just got rid of it, you know, sold it. It does seem like the person it was sold to is at least trying to take it back to what it was before. But it's always hard to go back when you've tried to evolve into something different. And,
well,
and
we say all this as prologue to the next story, which is Peter Thiel, PayPal Mafia, one of the founders of PayPal, got a lot of money, became a venture capitalist, early investor, very early, maybe first investor in Facebook, made a little money there, and now is taking some of his money, what was it, $40 million, to fund Hulk Hogan and perhaps others' lawsuit against Gawker.
It's at least one other he confessed to.
Yeah,
he's admitted this. And I'm glad I'm surrounded by journalists because this is one that's very difficult for me. On a personal level, I loathe Gawker, and I understand why Peter Thiel hated Gawker. They outed him against his wishes.
The reporter, I think it's important to say that the reporter who wrote that story feels very strongly that he did not out him, that he was already. Yeah.
He was told all his friends, so I'm going to tell the rest of the world is his attitude.
Right.
Which is BS, and I'm sorry, I don't buy it. Gawker, by the way, is the king of rationalizations. Every single crap article they've published has a similar rationalization. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Though that in this case, I mean, Owen Thomas has been very clear from the beginning. He doesn't feel that it was outing.
Owen is an ass.
I'm not saying
Nick Denton is an ass. Those are the worst kind of people ever. They're horrible. And talk about going for the money as opposed to going for the self-interest. And then they justify it with, well, you know, Silicon Valley's never been covered and they deserve to. And that's BS. And yet, as much as I hate to admit it, it's completely wrong for Peter Thiel to fund lawsuits against them, either openly or covertly. I'm very torn on this, and I believe in the First Amendment. And the last thing you want is billionaires deciding, oh, we're gonna even if there's no merit in this, we're gonna sue these guys out of existence because we don't like what they're saying.
Gawker has done horrible stuff.
They're horrible.
I actually know Owen Thomas from way back, and I've got to say he's a sweet guy.
Yeah, they're everybody who knows Nick and Owen and all the other Sam says they're nice guys. I'm sure Hitler was a nice guy in the bunker.
No, Hitler wasn't a nice guy.
Oh, no.
I'm just saying there's a difference between personal what you personally apprehend about somebody and what their output is.
Well, Gawker's rationale is we're going to dig up anything that we find interesting that we think people will click on. And it's not that different from most websites, except most websites have better taste.
I would say so. There's a legitimate. Okay. I'm not saying it's completely legitimate, but having someone report on the people who are in power in Silicon Valley makes sense.
Absolutely.
Because those people are dictating all kinds of things.
His sexuality is not germane in any way, and whether or not he told his friends, it's not appropriate. Sorry.
I don't know. I mean, in that case, in the concept of that article, I agree with you. But just to make, I mean, I'm not in any way advocating the outing of anyone at all. Having said that, at all, but I don't think that you can say that sexuality and some of those issues are not germane to certain things, especially when there were bills like Prop 8 happening at the time and people who are quiet or not quiet. I mean, Brendan Eich was fired for good reason, I think, from Mozilla because he backed Prop 8. And when that came into account, he was fired from Mozilla. Are we going to say that was something that shouldn't have been public, that there should have been reporting about the fact that he'd given money to anti-gay causes and then wanted to be the CEO of a company? I think that it's more nuanced than that. Sometimes people's personal lives and what they support and what they say can have an impact on the bigger picture and what their investments are and what the things they stand for are. I would never have published what Owen published. I never would have written that in. And I don't know if I'd ever want to work at a place that would have done that. But I don't think that it's as easy and cut and dry to say that the things that the Gawker has published didn't have news value, because I think that many of them, even as distasteful as they might be, totally do.
I might disagree with you on that. And by the way, I don't think it was Gawker that outed Eich on that.
I don't think it was either, but I'm just saying, but to the broader point of their...
I'm not sure if somebody's politics are germane to whether they should be the CEO of a company or not.
I don't know.
Maybe that's fair game.
I think we're in the middle of a big historical shift on quote-unquote important issues. So, like, if you think back into, like, even Kennedy, covering President Kennedy and all of his affairs, everyone in the press corps knew it. But no one wrote about
it. And that's
shameful. It was a different time.
I agree.
And we can look back on this, perhaps, as, you know, as people who are gay or normal.
Peter Thiel was an entrepreneur, not a president of the United States. I mean, the case you would make for Kennedy being sexuality being reported on is because he's the president of the United States, and perhaps he'd be vulnerable because of this. I don't know. I mean, and by the way, it's all moot because we have the First Amendment, and I really would hate to see money being, you know, thrown at people just kind of trying to put them out of business because of their reporting. So my point is, I hate Gawker. I'm not a fan of any of those people, But at the same time, they have the right to do it. God damn it. Right?
Yes, but I'm sure people who are writing about Peter Thiel now will think twice.
Well, precisely. Right. And you saw, I love the Joy of Tech comic where...
let's see it.
Oh, you know, these guys are really good. And we, you know, disclosure, they do all our album art and we love them. What's so wrong that Peter Thiel, the tech billionaire, has been secretly bankrolling lawsuits against Gawker? It's scary. It's a threat of freedom to the press. Look, Gawker's evil and publishes horrible things. As far as I'm concerned, it's karma. Ha! One billionaire decides he's offended by something, so now he's litigating it off the face of the earth. The guy's no hero. He's a bully. But Gawker's ruined many people's lives and reputations, wouldn't you agree? That doesn't matter. Thiel's actions are a corruption of our legal system. It sends a chilling message to other members of the media to be very careful about who they are, who they're writing about, and what they say about them. Why are you kicking me? Why do you keep looking over there? Oh, OMG, it's Peter Thiel. Ah, hi. Nice day, isn't it? You're looking sharp, sir. Can I just say I love PayPal and Facebook? Please don't sue me. I think that kind of sums it up. And who was it? Was it the New Yorker? I think it was in the New Yorker. One of their writers wrote a love letter to Peter Thiel because now it's like...
It was Wired.
Wired. That's right, Wired. And it's a satire, obviously, because nobody's really doing that. But it does sound a chilling effect that, you know, oh, I better not write about this guy. And absolutely, these are the new, very powerful, very rich people who would very much like to operate in secrecy and private. And so we do need good journalists to write about them. I'm not sure their sexuality is fair game. And that's the problem I think people had with Gawker is they didn't draw a line at what was fair game and what wasn't fair game. In fact, the more clicks, the better, right?
Gawker's the TMZ of...
Right. So, and I found it very disingenuous of Nick to say, well, we're just speaking truth to power. No, you're not. You're buying clicks. That's all. That's not truth to power.
In some cases, by speaking truth to power, that's a good... that's a good business model, too.
Oh, I would love it if that's what they did, but...
Gawker has said for a while, I don't think this is their model now, but during that time period especially, they had a model of you work on something investigative and fun, but you kind of finance that time with clicky articles.
Right.
So in that case, you know, every page view for them is a chance to spend time on something real and reported. And they do actual real reporting.
They do.
And I should point out, and we know this because we've had Roberto Baldwin on the show, and he used to work. He worked for TMZ and Harvey Levine in the early days, that there is, frankly, a well-known and encouraged symbiosis between stars and starlets and their coverage by TMZ. They want the coverage. You know, Britney Spears doesn't wear underpants because she wants to get a picture taken of her.
Well, it's good for
business. And so there's a symbiosis that's very different from what Gawker's doing. So,
although I will say, having spoken with Owen in the past about this, in the early days, at least, of Valley Wag, for some of their stuff, there was a symbiosis between what was happening with certain members of the Valley and Valley Wag, too. They were after the same things. I mean, do you think that they wrote all those stories about Julia Allison because she was that interesting? No, it's because she was a fame whore who was emailing them tips about herself all the time.
Right.
Like, I mean, I think this is the case with all the press. I mean, there's a certain symbiosis where, you know, you get pitched things and people try to kind of put things in your ear and say, oh, this is really interesting. You know, that's how stories break. So
Denton has suggested a debate with Thiel. Will that happen?
No.
God, it would be so amazing if it did. Peter Thiel would be crazy stupid to take
him up on
that. He would
be crazy. Peter Thiel doesn't need to do this. I mean, to me, the thing that bothered me the most, I'm actually not that bothered if Peter Thiel wants to back a lawsuit of Hulk Hogan, even if it has nothing to do with him, because that's a fact of our legal system is that you can be supported by third parties. And I don't have a huge problem with that, even though I think it's distasteful to try to put something out of business simply because you don't like some of the things they've written about you and your friends. But what bothered me about it was, frankly, the fact that it was done secretly. The fact that you know, this has been something that's been under wraps for years and that we just now found out about it this week. That to me is very troubling, because I do feel like if you are, you know, facing the sort of lawsuit that they were facing against Hulk Hogan, you should be able to face your accuser, which in this case, Hulk Hogan is a proxy. And the real person is Peter Thiel. And that makes it very different, I think. And as, you know, the public, we should be, as anybody, you should be aware of who's actually accusing you.
Yeah, and it changed the legal strategy on the case. I mean, like, not settling, and it kind of distorts the way you would view the arguments even. So, I mean, if you're going to read that closely into the case, I don't know. Should we talk about Oracle? Because that's
yes,
big and exciting.
I'm going to take a break, but I will quote the phony Voltaire quote. I disapprove of what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And as journalists, I think we have to question Peter Thiel's motivations and support the First Amendment. But I'm really mad at you, Nick Denton, for putting me in that position. I'm sure Owen's very nice. Is Peter Thiel nice? Isn't he?
I have no idea.
He was the model for the weird VC at the beginning of Silicon Valley, right? The kind of on the spectrum strange person.
Yeah, the one who discovered hamburgers. Do people like hamburgers?
No, that's satire, but see, that I like.
And then he cornered the market in sesame seeds or something. He made
it because people like hamburgers, and there are sesame seeds on the bun of the hamburger.
The guy who played him died.
I know, very sad, because it was a great character. And he knew, this I didn't know, but he knew he was dying when he created the character. He knew he had cancer, and it was his kind of his last work. And wow, what a great job he did.
What a funny show that is.
Yeah, it's very good.
Great show.
See that Dan Lyons guy isn't all bad. Just teasing. We're going to take a break. Come back. Let's talk about, I mean, we've been burying the lead here. The big story of the week, Oracle and Google. Did the good guys win? Our show today brought to you by Headspace. If all of this is raising your blood pressure, and you know, words, thoughts can raise your blood pressure, can increase your fear and your anxiety and your stress. I say the word Gawker, my heart starts pounding. I get excited. I get upset. That's why I have Headspace. Mindful meditation made simple. A thousand-year-old tradition, sure, but there are thousands of scientific studies that show the positive effects of meditation. It improves focus. It improves relationship harmony. It decreases anxiety and stress. And, man, there's nothing like Headspace. Created by Andy Puddicombe. You might have seen his TED Talk. 5.5 million people have. You may have play the audio on this, because this is Andy's voice. He is such a...
And follow the simple instructions to get going.
He's got...
The
such
best
a
place to start is...
Down to earth.
It's a free 10-day program where you can learn the basics of meditation in just 10 minutes.
I just love Andy, and I love having him in my head.
Enjoy Take 10
saying,
and learn more.
It's not froofy. It's not, you know, all mystical. It's really just down to earth, lovely meditations. He guides them. He knows his stuff. Sure, he was a monk for 10 years. I mean, he understands, you know, kind of the deep roots of meditation, but he does it in a way that's just really accessible and fun and very effective. They have a Take 10 program, 10 days of guided meditation, just 10 minutes a day, and you can do it right now for free if you go to headspace.com/twit. I'm not kidding. You will sleep better. You'll feel better. You will be happier. Train your mind for a healthier, less stressed life. Start, and it's free. Why not do it? Download the app, iOS or Android, headspace.com/twit. 5 million users now, including, I'm told, let's do a little TMZ, Emma Watson. Hermione. Is that Hermione?
That's Hermione.
Hermione does Headspace. Jared Leto, Gwyneth Paltrow. They're all Headspace, happy Headspace users. All right. So, boy, this is Google Oracle thing has been going on for years.
6 years.
It's an absurdly complicated case that boiled down to the least important part of the whole case, and which is ridiculous. Do I need to give the summary, or have you seen it enough on all of our shows that I don't have to tell you how this started? Or, you know, Java was written by Sun, blah, blah, blah. Android used Java. Maybe they copied the code. They say they didn't. They just copied the API. Talked to James Gosling, the inventor of Java. He says, yeah, we felt like they slimed us, but we weren't going to sue them over it. But then the Oracle lawyers arrived during the acquisition talks, and Gosling says, yeah, we feel like they copied the code, but we're not going to sue them, are we, guys? And he said the lawyer's eyes lit up. And they said, there's some gold in that there, son. Of course, Oracle did sue Google, saying you copied Java, but they did it in a weird way. Apparently, the lawyers, at first, I think that they had 9 lines of code. They said, look, they're exactly the same. It was an array bounce checker. The judge, Alsup, learned Java and wrote his own arranged bound checker just to say, you know, not that unique. He felt that this was not really theft and ruled in favor of Google. Oracle appealed, and using a loophole, I guess I am going through the whole story, using a loophole, this managed to get the appeal not to go to the Ninth Circuit Court out here in the West Coast that knows a little bit about this stuff and probably would have ruled in Google's favor, but instead got it sent up to the federal court, which is in charge of patents. And because of some patent law here, they got the case, and they said, well, no, Oracle can copyright the code. And furthermore, the API. And Google violated the Oracle. Maybe they didn't copy the code, but by violating the copyright on the API, we rule in favor of Oracle. Google appealed. Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to take this case. Sent it back down to Judge Alsop saying, you got to first figure out, we're not debating whether Google stole the code. We're not debating whether you can copyright an API. That's been decided. You can copyright an API, which seems like a stupid idea. But anyway, what we're trying to figure out is it okay that Google copied the copyrighted API because it's fair use? And that's what the case was all about. A jury of 10 people, none of them tech experts, because Oracle made sure there were no tech experts on the jury, deliberated for 3 days and decided that, no, in fact, it was fair use. Google was, even though the API is copyrighted, mm-hmm. It was fair use, and Google's off the hook. Now Oracle says, well, we're going to appeal, and it's going to go right back to the federal court. Did I accurately describe that scenario? I always feel like I'm getting something wrong.
No, that was really impressive. Yeah, but you didn't say that this happened. This came down before Memorial Day weekend, so all the tech journalists could write their stories and relax.
Nice of them. Thank you, jury.
Yeah, I thought that was nice. Yes,
it was nice.
Of course, Joe Mullins from Ars was in there, and there were a number of journalists had to sit through all the testimony. And there was
Sarah Jong. Sarah Jong.
Yeah.
Her live tweets were fantastic.
They were fabulous. And, of course, speaking of hamburgers, former Sun CEO Jonathan Schwartz, trying to explain what an API is, somehow managed to put hamburgers on a breakfast menu, and it was very confusing. Anyway, and the judge, by the way, was confused and said, that's silly, that's stupid, and then mocked the fact that GNU, because I guess they were trying to explain open source, too, because that part
They're trying to explain GNU, and somebody said, wait, GNU, the G in GNU stands for GNU.
Yeah.
It was great. It was the fact that recursive acronyms rather were being.
I think Judge Alsop kind of knew, because he wasn't. By the way, I didn't realize this, but he has his BS in mathematics, so he's. I give him more credit.
And he presided over the first case.
Right.
He's
the guy who learned Java.
Yeah, exactly. He ruled in Google's favor the first time back in 2012, and then it got sent to the federal circuit and then sent back. So, yeah, I have a feeling that he might have known, but I just love the fact that recursive acronyms were an actual thing being discussed in open court. That's like the greatest thing ever.
By the way, Oracle's response to this is, oh, this is really bad for open source.
I'm sorry. That's really funny. As if Oracle cares about open source at all.
Yeah, I'm not really sure I can really follow the logic, but it has something to do with the GPL. And if you can't copyright APIs, I don't know. I can't even repeat it. It's so convoluted. But they said this is going to be terrible for the GPL.
It might not be great for the GPL, but I mean, that's why there are so many other permissive open source licenses other than the GPL. I mean, this maybe isn't great for the GPL version 3. Version 2, I think, is probably fine, but who knows?
Anyway, anything to say about this? The good guys won, is, I think we all agree, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, it's not over.
That's true.
It got overturned got sent back at the Court of Appeals the first time. Florian Mueller, you know who he is?
Yeah.
Yeah, Boss Patents.
He's usually pretty good on this stuff, but sometimes he's in the pay of one of the parties, right. And I think in this case
he was an expert witness.
Yeah,
I think
Oracle's been paying him on this the whole time. Yeah. So his analysis, to be totally fair, even though I agree with you, a lot of times he's good on this stuff, I can't take seriously just because he's an expert for Oracle.
He says no reasonable, properly instructed jury could have found for Google.
He says that the judge gave an overly broad definition.
It was
of
rigged.
Fair use.
And he could be right. There probably are grounds for appeal. I'm sure that Oracle will appeal and might get, you know, go to the federal circuit again, and then from there it might go to the Supreme Court. You never know. But
troubling is that it's the fact that APIs could be copyrightable.
Yeah,
well, APIs are copyrightable.
We know they are, but why is that okay, Stacey?
No, I mean, I think that's a dumb decision, but we're stuck with it.
Well, so I guess the Supreme Court could change that, or Congress.
Well, the Supreme Court said they're not going to hear it.
No, they could review it. They sent it back to the lower court for this decision.
And they're bringing it back now that that's decided?
That's decided. So now they can, if they wished, of course, the Supreme Court could do anything they want. But they didn't say we're not going to talk about it. They deferred it.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of that. I thought
that's what Denise Howell, who's our resident attorney and IP lawyer.
I would trust her. I would trust her then. Yeah. I wasn't clear on that. I knew that they sent it back for the fair use question.
They didn't reject it entirely. They said we're not going to rule at this point. We want the lower court to rule on this fair use first.
Gotcha. Okay.
So the idea of a copyrightable API. I'm not going to use a hamburger and a breakfast menu. Let me use the automobile. Thank God everybody has agreed that the gas pedal is on the right and the brake is on the left. No matter what car you drive, you get in the car. The steering wheel may be on the other side, but the gas pedal is always in the same place. That's like an API where we've all agreed this is how you do it. It doesn't mean you can't build a gas pedal that works differently. Doesn't mean your brakes have to be drum brakes or disc brakes. It just means that for the purposes of the people using your car, that there is a standard for how you interact with it. Failing that, you've got no internet. You've got no computers. You've got nothing, because I can say, well, I have an API, but you can't use it because it's copyrighted. Now, that seems to me problematic.
Well, now, companies, what happens when a company is not opening up their API?
That's fine. We have, for instance, we do that. Okay. We wrote, our website has an API, public and private. In fact, this is very common. You have a public API and a private API. You keep some, we're not going to give out the API for doing stuff that we don't think an app would want to do, because that's ours. And we are the ones who should be able to name a show, for instance. That's, you know, there may be an API to do that, but we're not going to make that public. Or give people, and by the way, it's not merely the knowledge of it that's needed. You also need a token, and you need to have a system where the API call can actually do that. Unless you're us, you can't. So not only do we not reveal it, it's not publicly usable. That's fine. We're not saying that. But open source requires publicly usable APIs, right?
And then there are cases where people will reverse engineer and do clean room implementations. You know, you look at something like Samba for file sharing, where they took SMB, you know, which was the Windows file sharing protocol, and did a reverse engineer of that and created the Samba protocol. At this point, I don't think it would be in Microsoft's best interest to ever sue that project. It's been around for a long enough time, and it's become a core part of Linux and other POSIX operating systems. But, you know, you do worry that with the API copyrightability thing, even though it was a clean room implementation, even though they did not use any of Microsoft's code, that because they, you know, re-implemented the API and kind of built it on their own, that could become, you know, there could be legal challenges against things like that. And that's a concern.
Florian says that the judge misinstructed the jury, making the hurdle for fair use too low. He said it's an exception. The hurdle should be fairly high. And he also points out, and this is important, that a trial is not a jury decision is not a precedent.
Right.
So it doesn't set any precedent of any kind. So it doesn't resolve the question of copyright APIs and whether APIs can be copied.
Well, no, that has been, because the Federal Circuit did say that.
Yeah.
So what it says, though, is that just because it was deemed fair use in this case does not mean that that would have a bearing in a future case, meaning that if you did want to sue over someone, you know, using your API and you wanted to claim it was fair use, the fact that this jury ruled in Google's favor would not have bearing on that in most cases. That's his argument, and that's fair. And so that kind of, I think, even though it's a good thing that Google has won so far, this is not over. And this probably won't be over until we get some sort of definitive ruling, you know, one way or another from a higher court.
Florian said that mismanagement at Sun really was the problem, that they allowed Google to incorporate Java's API into Android. That was against the law then, and they should have pursued it. So Google doesn't have any fair use exemption or license because of ineptitude on the part of Jonathan Schwartz, who he calls one of the industry's worst CEOs ever.
There's probably something to be said there in the fact that when Google was developing Android and they were using Java's APIs, they didn't want to pay for Java's some of their whatever the mobile Java stuff was at the time. And frankly, when it came out, when Dalvik came out, and it was so clear that they were, you know, kind of reverse engineering the stuff that was already available from Sun probably should have stepped in at that point and said, hey, actually, this isn't okay. You need to pay us a license for this. That probably would have been the best thing to do and probably been, frankly, a much better business decision for Sun to do at that time, since their server business was all but dead and no one cared about Solaris. And they could have probably, and I think at that time in 2007, 2008, you know, Google might have been more amenable to paying the licensing fee. You never know. But they didn't push for it, and it took Oracle buying them. And as you were saying, actually kind of looking and realizing, oh, wait a minute, there are actually some potential legal things here that we could sue over that made this the court case that it is. And by that point, Android was huge.
A dumb question. Is there any sense that Larry Ellison brought this suit to help his buddy Steve Jobs?
Interesting. Who was...
You know, I don't think so. I mean, that's an interesting question because I thought about that too. I'm trying to remember the timing. I think that Steve Jobs' thermonuclear comments about Android, I think, were after this. But that does kind of... The timeline would not be wrong.
They certainly were in alignment.
Definitely. And I mean, and I think you do look at, I think there, this gets conspiratorial thinking, but I think it is a valid question to ask, you know, when they bought Sun, you know, because they immediately got rid of the Spark stuff because that wasn't making any money. That was an albatross. And they got, MySQL, which, you know, was already starting to come up against, you know, Oracle's database stuff. And they got Java. If you wonder if doing their own due diligence as a company, if Oracle realized that one of the main reasons that they would spend what they spent on Sun was for the potential legal benefits and taking on Google. I don't know. But I think it probably, I don't know. I have a feeling that any lawyer who would be looking or any business person would be looking at the assets of Sun to buy it, you would have to think about, are there potential, you know, patents or you know, royalty agreements we can squeeze out of other companies that aren't already being executed that way, and can we make money that way?
I would encourage anybody who wants to know more, read Foss patents, Florian Mueller's post on several posts on Foss patents, rejecting this whole thing and saying this is a dumb move by the jury, that fair use is not a defense, and that Google, in fact, did act inappropriately and intentionally in their commercial interest and to Sun's later Oracle's detriment. Because he does make some good points. You know, it's not as cut and dry as maybe some of us think.
I mean, I think he makes some good points, but I mean, I think ultimately he is someone who's being paid by Oracle to kind of, you know, play this out and to write the post that he writes. So I don't reject his opinion. I just think that we should all be aware that he's obviously being paid by Oracle to say this. So of course he's...
Well, I'm not sure if that's like, the case. He was paid by Oracle at one point. I don't know if he's currently being paid.
I don't know if he's currently as he used to be. He was definitely a consultant and has testified at their other trials. So he's not a disinterested party is all I'm saying.
Right. Fascinating stuff. I think that's enough on it, though. Don't have anything more to say about it. Anybody? Anything? No.
I'd like to hear more about Stacy's project. What are you doing, Stacy, and how are you making money?
Oh, that's a loaded question, isn't it?
That is, man. I'll do the quick rundown because I think most people know, but I'm doing a podcast on the Internet of Things.
Very
the Internet
good one,
of Things
by the
podcast.
Way. Yeah.
It's awesome. Everyone should watch it.
Yeah.
No reason. Listen to it. And then I do a weekly newsletter that's free, and it's just everything about the Internet of Things, plus a startup profile and an essay. And I sell advertisements because I didn't want to go the Patreon kind of please give me money route, because I hate asking for money.
Right. I know.
Well, I went the other way because I hate advertisements.
You know what? They're both completely legitimate choices. I think that there's room in the world for both, right?
I feel validated. Thank you, Leo.
Yeah. Well, no, you know, so we started doing what you wanted to do, Philip, which is I thought, well, we'll just go directly to our listeners. And we were able to raise a decent amount of money, but not enough to grow. So we would have done one podcast. I mean, you know, that's the difference is how much you can make that way. And we would have been able to do one podcast and that would be it. And so we ended up, I remember talking to an ad agency saying, we will never take ads. And after only a few years, I said, you know what, we're going to take ads because in the long run, that's the only way we can grow. And we're just going to try to do it in a responsible, respectful to our audience manner. But I think both make sense. Nowadays, I mean, had Patreon been around and other crowdfunding options, maybe I would have done it differently, but...
Well, your ads are different from the ads that pop up on a news feed.
They're targeted. They're,
what are they? What are they called? The ones that are like interstitial.
Interstitial.
Yeah. 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 And that, you know, it's like the old Arthur Godfrey radio model.
I'm very influenced by Arthur Godfrey. Only you and I have ever seen Arthur Godfrey, but I'm very.
I use this razor. I love it. Yeah. You'll like it too.
It's a very old-fashioned way of doing ads.
Right, but it flows, and you know, you might go pee, but you might listen to the ad. It's different than the stuff that pops in your face, and if you try to block it,
right.
Then they say, well, we're not going to show you any content. You'll turn off your ad blocker, and all the other, the movies that start themselves. That's what I'm trying to get away from.
Oh, I don't blame you. And by the way, Stacey's ad model is exactly the same as ours. Most podcasts are, I think.
Because you hopefully have a link with your listeners.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I love hearing from my listeners and they talk to me and I talk to them.
It gets down to what I was saying earlier, which is that the way to monetize, and this works for both models, by the way, is by building a relationship with your audience and getting an audience that wants to support you in doing what you're doing. And they can, you know, ads or donations, it's very similar. I think a lot of our audience says, well, I want to support you, so I patronize your sponsors.
Yeah, I click on sponsors for people I like.
Yeah, but I think ultimately, if in this new medium, any new medium, you're going to have to succeed by, and that's what's great about it, it's a direct connect. In the days of mass media, it was not a direct connection. And that's why you're liking this, Philip, is because you're hearing from your audience. You're talking to them directly. It's not intermediated by a publisher and a press and a large organization. And I think for musicians, it's going to be the same. I think for everybody, it's going to be the same. It's about finding an audience. And to do that, you find your voice. You have to find your passion. You have to be knowledgeable. I think you have to operate with integrity, although I guess it's different if you're a comedian or something. Integrity doesn't matter. You have to be funny then.
I always cared a lot about my comment stream, and which was very frustrating because timing didn't. And they kept killing off. They choose a different platform and I'd lose all my readers. And so the one thing that I've done, the innovation on Apple 3.0 is it's real names only.
I like that. I think that's very effective, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, it makes it a safer place, a safer women too. I have a lot of women subscribers and they're not as active on the boards as the men, but the men aren't going to go calling them. What did that study? You know, they're not going to be calling them names because they're using their real name. And they, you know, there's a shame in acting badly when your real name's attached.
Yeah.
So anyway, I've seen so many, you know, you and I, we've been around for a long time, Leon. We've watched boards go bad in all sorts of ways. And one of the great ones was The Well, where you had to use your real name and people were respectful.
Isn't it sad? Yeah. I really, and the well had its share of flame wars, but at least you knew who was flaming you.
Right, right. And you could look up and see who they were.
Yeah, and I think Godwin's Law was actually created for the well in 1990.
Right. Yeah, I noticed that you violated it
instantly.
A few minutes ago. In the comments, you picked up on it right away.
Yeah, no, they know Godwin's Law very well, and by the way, he wrote an article a few days ago saying he created it. It wasn't a prediction. It was a warning. Mike Godwin actually wrote about Godwin's Law a few days ago in the IBT.
That's cool.
Yeah. He says, based on my early experience of online arguments, I'd come up with this mock law, which was meant to have the sound and seeming inevitability of a law in physics or mathematics. Quote, as an online discussion continues, the probability of a comparison to Hitler or to Nazis approaches one. In other words, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. He says, I admit to being a prankster. He was actually intentionally trying to create something that would take on a life of its own and become a law and, in the sense of, memorable. And he says he based it on computer bulletin boards. So yeah.
I noticed that the New York Times on the front page today had a long article about comparing Trump to fascism.
There you go.
And I wondered how long it was going to take people to do that, because you don't want to go there, because once you've invoked Hitler, it's like people go nuts.
Well, that's why I think they've started with Mussolini, so they have somewhere to go. He was fascist, but it wasn't that bad yet. You know, it's that kind of thing. It's going to be bad, but it's not yet. Anyway,
I was surprised. If you read the whole article, they have a long paragraph of all the people comparing him, Trump, to Hitler, and it's quite a few people.
Yeah, a lot of people went there. Yeah. Godwin says, I designed Godwin's Law not to be predictive, but to be mimetic, not to show that debates would invariably become overheated, but to spur debaters to invoke history mindfully through a meme with deeper analysis rather than glib allusion. In other words, he was trying to prevent that from happening. And by making his law a meme, he didn't expect it to become true. Unfortunately, it has. he thought the law would discourage people from invoking Hitler.
He's giving people way more credit than
yes, he is. We're going to take a break, come back. We will talk about Twitter and their misogyny problem. I think that's probably what you were thinking of in the back of your mind. Study by a UK think tank, which found in just... 3-week period, 10,000 explicitly aggressive and misogynistic tweets in the UK alone. Shocking. There's gambling going on Twitter. Shocking. Our show today, let me reach over, is brought to you by this. It's my keychain. Well, it's not brought to you by my keychain, but the fact that I have my keychain is thanks to this. This is the tracker. It's a coin-sized tracking device. Kind of pretty, this new... The new Tracker Bravo is an anodized aluminum, tough and light, very thin. And what happens is it's Bluetooth LE, Bluetooth low energy, pairs to your phone. The battery lasts a year because it is LE. You can even get a water resistant case. You can put it on your pet. You can put it on your keys. You can put it on anything that you lose a lot. And then you'll know when you get separated from it. In fact, there's two-way separation, because the tracker will let you know when you get separated from your phone, and the phone will let you know when you get separated from your keys. Press the button on the tracker. Your phone will ring even if it's on silent. There's all sorts of... You can choose your own ringtone. I know our former producer Jason used to have like a klaxon horn. And then they do something really interesting. Because as you know, Bluetooth only goes 30 meters, 100 feet. But Tracker has the largest crowd GPS network in the world. If you scroll down a little bit, Karsten, on the website, you can see the map, the current map of trackers. 1.5 million trackers in the real world. And when you come anywhere near, it's not on our, there it is, there it is. When you come anywhere near a tracker, so let's say I leave my keys at a truck stop in Modesto. Now, I've driven away. My phone will know where the last place it saw the keys, maybe that's not it. Maybe somebody picked them up and moved them. Whenever another phone that's got the tracker software and it gets near my keys, it will register its location, and I'll get a GPS update on the map. So I'll know if my keys move where they went. They also have, and this is another thing, it's great. I mean, you know your keys are in your house, but we're in your house. They have Tracker Atlas, which works with your Tracker Bravo or a third-party Bluetooth tracker to pinpoint your items on a customizable floor plan of your home. In the cushions, no problem. Tracker will tell you. You just ask Tracker Atlas, where are my keys? And you'll get an answer. You don't even have to look for them. This is so cool. I want you to go to thetracker, thetracker.com, no E in the tracker. And never lose your possessions again. And if you use the promo code TWIT, 30% off your whole order. 30%. Thetracker.com, promo code TWIT for 30% off. I love this little thing. What I do, by the way, you notice my keys are on a chain, is then I attach it to my backpack or my bag, whatever I'm carrying around. So now I've doubled, it's doing double duty. If I leave my bag behind, it'll let me know, as well as my keys.
Will it work for my dog?
Yes. Now, our dog's pretty little, and I guess I could put this on Ozzy. It's pretty light. The cats,
my dog has tried to chew off their tracker.
Really?
That's my dog's special.
Your dog ate your tracker?
I'm using a generic tracker, but yes.
These trackers, you should try these trackers. They're not as tasty.
There we go.
They're anodized aluminum. I don't think a dog's going to take a bite.
I don't know. I had a dog who once ate exterior lighting.
That's deeply disturbing.
It was. He literally ate the lights. He was a special dog. He's very, very sweet.
Aww.
Not the best dog, but
at least
so
he's
sweet.
Getting his minerals.
Yeah.
I don't even know if this is a news story. New study shows the scale of Twitter's misogyny problem. Here's the only thing that's a little surprising. A surprising number of women may have contributed to the abuse. So it turns out this is that what you were talking about. Being anonymous, people will do horrible things on Twitter because no one knows who you are. And in fact, it turns out that of 1.5 million tweets sent in the UK during a three-week period from mid-April to May, the research team lifted out conversational or self-identifying tweets to focus only on those with clearly aggressive language aimed at another user. 10,000 explicitly aggressive and misogynistic tweets, you know, you slut, you, that kind of thing, directed at 6,500 users. There were more than 20,000 tweets using the same terms directed at 80,000 users internationally. So if you just UK, it's a smaller set. But here's the weird thing. Half of them sent by women.
That made me think that it was maybe like sister to sister talk.
Sisters don't call out the sisters sluts.
Well, they might.
I mean, no slut shame in here.
Okay, first of all, you have to always wonder: Are they really women?
Good point.
So that's number one. And number two, I would say, as a woman, there are plenty of other women out there who can be pretty terrible to people online. Yes. People are people. It does not come down across gender lines. I know it's popular to say that, but people can be terrible regardless of their gender or whatever norm or wherever you want to fall on that spectrum. So, you know, people on the internet are terrible is, I think, kind of my big takeaway.
I don't know if I buy this, but the researchers say, no, we could tell if you're a woman by how you talked. And we think it's about 85% accurate.
Okay. Well, 85% accurate is still not that
still
accurate.
Still not accurate. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean,
You don't need a study to know this.
Yeah,
People tend to yell at women online.
Right.
Other women yell at women.
Right.
Other women tend to judge other women more oftentimes than men do in certain circumstances, and that's always been the case.
Knock it off, everybody. Just be nice.
Well, it's worse. It's worse than that. Women have been chased off the internet, right?
Oh, yeah.
I'm still on the internet.
Can I just say, Stacey and Christina, I admire
individual
you
women. Yeah,
because
individual
I women. Know, and my wife too. I know a woman in public is considered by some percentage, small, I hope, percentage of people, to be mouthing off just by virtue of being in public. You know, to be a loud mouth and they will go after you just by virtue of being in public. They are terrible, terrible,
absolutely.
And I don't know a single woman who's in public on the internet who hasn't seen. I see enough abuse for myself. Far worse stuff than I've ever seen. Far worse. It's horrible.
This particular survey, I thought the words they picked are probably there. That might be the higher incidence of women because women tend to call other, if right. you picked like rape threats, you'd probably see more men.
I would agree with that.
So that's.
Yeah. Okay. So we could throw that out. Who cares anyway? We don't know if there were other women shaming women. It was just people shaming women. But it's just, sure. It's just sad. I mean, I feel it's so saddening to me. As a father of a daughter, as a husband, I have a mother and a sister. I just, it's sad.
Say something. I mean, seriously.
Well, should we or should, I mean, there. Yeah, okay, this is a big argument. Ignore it or do something.
No.
So no, do something. People worry about, yeah, go on.
Okay. When I worked at Giga Ohm, there was somebody who came on in the comments, I want to say, and said something about me that was just completely, it wasn't like a rape threat or anything. It was just being a jerk to me online. And he got in, he was like, you offer no value here. F off. And I was like, holy cow, I can't believe he did that. But then in another instance, you know, someone, I don't know, it was a picture of me that ran with something. And it was like, nice legs or something like that.
Oh,
he was like,
God.
Unacceptable. And he just deleted it.
Good
and
for
he
home.
Put it on social cast. And he Good was like, home. This is completely, yeah. you know, but you should say those things. And my best offenders often in our comments were other men.
Yeah.
They were like, but shut up, Stacey knows what she's talking about.
On comments, if somebody's really bad, you can get rid of them.
Yeah, but
you can't get rid of somebody on Twitter. They will remain.
You should you can report them. You can,
yeah, then they just come back.
No, and so do, you get in the whack-a-mole game. But I mean, I think there is some value in publicly saying whether you're men or women. But I think men, I think anybody, when you see people badgering others, sticking up and saying this is not okay.
If we all did that, I think you're right. I mean, if anytime somebody posted something just horrible on Twitter, everybody responded to them, you jerk, you, that would make it go away?
For some people, yes.
Some people like the negative attention. In fact, I think the worst trolls love it.
Of course they do. But I think that a lot of...
Then aren't you pouring fuel on the fire?
Well, for those people, but I think...
Sorry. Okay, go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, no. I was just going to say, I think that for some people, that you're never going to, but those people you're never going to have any chance of reaching. The worst trolls are going to troll regardless, okay? Right. Those people you're never going to reach. But I think that there's a broader amount of people who say terrible things online who do it for two reasons. One, they don't actually see what they're saying as the person they're targeting as being an actual person. And I've run through this myself with people who've said some terrible things to me when I've had kind of an actual conversation with them back, and they kind of realize, oh, you're not just this person, you know, this username in the ether and this photo on the internet, you're a real person. They'll often apologize. But I think that the other thing is that, you know, people feel like there's certain behavior is allowed because it's the internet. And there is something to be said about standing up and saying this is not okay. Again, you're right. The people that are going to hate on and just want to do it because they like the world to burn, they're never going to stop.
And that's probably a very small number, truthfully, very small number of people. A lot of people, in my experience, some of these really people that are surprisingly horrible are kids. They're like 15-year-olds, and they just really aren't properly socialized yet. And a little bit of appropriate censure might actually turn them into nice people. And maybe that's we owe them that.
And maybe it's not. I mean, if someone's threatening to like chop off someone's head and do something horrible,
well, that you could do something about. That's illegal.
Yeah, but it's the more insidious things like. The assumptions that you would never, like a girl could never know about tech. Those are the kind of
those
things.
Those are hard
to
fight. Yeah.
You just say no. I mean, that's.
Yeah. Well, it's the dog whistles and the very subtle things that sometimes we don't even notice that can really be damaging in the long run too. Let's talk about Windows 10. Speaking of horrible things. So Microsoft says, no, we meant to do that. We're talking about, I got to find the picture because I want to ask you guys what you think would happen here. So let me, Carson, find this picture. I'm going to do a search for Windows 10 upgrade dialog box. This changed, the behavior changed this week. There are people, including our friend Paul Thurrott, who hosts our Windows Weekly show, who said Microsoft is being disgusting and damaging not only the reputation of Windows 10, but their own reputation. So here's what happened. As you all know, Microsoft decided that they wanted everybody to run Windows 10. And so they offered a free upgrade a year ago, July 29th, 2015. And anybody who was running Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 could get a free upgrade. Nice. Then they started nagging people. They started putting up dialog boxes to say, you're eligible. Want to upgrade? Want to upgrade? But it all really went to hell a couple of months ago when they moved the Windows 10 upgrade into recommended updates. For most Windows users, Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 users, their recommended updates are automatic. They happen. And that means there are a great many people, and I've talked to half of them now, who got upgraded to Windows 10 without their knowledge, without their consent, without their permission. Karsten, you did. It just happens. You did too, Chris. So you're sitting there running Windows 7, happy as a clam. All your software is working. Everything's just great. You love it. And the next morning you get up and there's a pop-up that says, congratulations, you've been upgraded to Windows 10. Say, do you agree? And if you don't agree to the license agreement, you say, no, I don't agree. Then it has to uninstall Windows 10, which can take a long time and often fails. Now, the last piece of the puzzle, this dialog box. Windows 10 is a recommended update for this PC. Based on your Windows update settings, as I referred to earlier, this PC is scheduled. Listen to the words carefully, and that's the problem people don't. Scheduled to upgrade on Sunday, in this case it says May 22nd at 11 p.m. Click here to change upgrade schedule or cancel scheduled upgrade. Now, if you didn't read that carefully, you might be tempted to click the OK box. Well, wait a minute. No, I don't want the upgrade. Let's see the cancel box. Oh, no, the cancel box says upgrade now. Well, both of those would do the upgrade. Either accept it or do it now. Do it sooner. Let's click the close box. And this is what's getting people upset. The presumption, I think, by the way, mistaken, that when you click that X, it cancels that. No. Mm-hmm. When you click that X, it puts the window away, but it's still scheduled for Sunday, May 22nd, 11 p.m. The only way to not be updated to Windows 10 is to click where it says click here and cancel. Microsoft said that's exactly our intent, but a lot of people are saying, well, no, wait a minute. That Xbox did used to cancel it. When did you change that and why? And you're tricking people in installing Windows 10. Your thoughts?
I think we're going to see this a lot more often.
Not just from Microsoft, but from everybody.
From everyone. I think this whole issue of getting upgraded against your will to features that you're like, what? That's been the software world forever. I mean, yes.
Thank you, Chrome.
Yeah, but that's different. That's Chrome 49 to 50. It's not a big change. You might not even notice the change. And frankly, we need to do it because Chrome is a browser. It's your interface to the internet where all the bad stuff sits. Wait.
Don't you need to upgrade Windows? I mean, look, I'm not defending
you're this, safe in Windows 7. There's also it's more than just upgrading a program, and it takes time. It's not 100% perfect, and some of your stuff may not work, including some of the hardware Microsoft didn't test for compatibility. And you know, I've talked to people like I talked to a guy whose wife was a teacher. She had a whole class presentation she needed to do. She got up in the morning. Windows 10 is on her system. And she's like, I can't run it. That's a big deal for people. I think that Microsoft did this wrong. I think I understand what they did here, but don't they owe it to people not to kind of trick them into upgrading? To make it very clear, there should be a big cancel button or no, I don't want to do this button.
I mean,
did they tell
one.
You to back up first?
No, of course not. They don't tell you anything. They just do it.
Again, you're going to see this more often at all levels. I mean, my car updates itself. It changes.
Well, yeah, you like, drive one of those cars that they're watching you at all times.
Exactly. Well, and as someone who has all these connected devices in my house, I can tell you there are plenty of times I wake up in the morning and my light switch doesn't work because it's updated and it broke whatever connection.
Stacey on IoT.com. You chose this.
I did. I mean, like I live this so I could, but that's why when I see what Microsoft's doing and I mean, you see it, let's see, someone just wrote about Uber trying to, there was the Google engineer who wrote about how software companies and tech companies are trying to influence your decisions via design. This is clearly one of those examples. Uber just is starting to do this with pushing people to Uber Pool in, I think it's Washington, D.C. And so it's a nudge, but I mean, we do this in policy all the time to get people to do what we want. The question is, do we want giant tech companies making this decision?
It's different in policy. I mean, I thought these companies were, you know, I mean, what happened to the customer's always right and customer centric business? And I mean,
we're not the customer in Windows we are. But for a lot of these businesses, we're kind of this ancillary. We're either a source of data or mm-hmm. we're a source of items. I mean,
or the product.
To Google, in other words, we're not the business. We're just the product.
Right. I think a lot of companies have that mentality, even when they're selling you a product, I'll be honest.
Clearly, Microsoft does. I understand. You know, and by the way, if I'm Microsoft, I understand this. They want to get everybody to Windows 10. Everybody uses Windows 10. It's easy to get application developers to support it. You probably could make the case it's more secure. Certainly, they're not going to want to continue to support Windows 7 forever.
They did say for a long time that you have a free upgrade, you know, from Windows 7, Windows 8 to Windows 10. And now they're saying, okay, at the end of June or whatever, that's when they're cutting that off. So if you do want to upgrade, now is the time to do it. I'm with you. They should make it really clear, you know, and you should have a really clear way to opt out and not do that. But I mean, a lot of people don't like change, and there were a lot of changes, you know, to Windows 8 and less to Windows 10, but still changes. And so, I mean, I think this is kind of they're in a weird situation. They need people to upgrade, but I'm with you that they could probably do this in a way that would be less shocking if you're, you know, by clicking an X button. Let's put it this way. You shouldn't click an X button and then still have it install anyway. That's not correct behavior. It's kind of like what we were talking about on MacBreak Weekly a couple weeks ago about, you know, iTunes and its terrible design for trying to delete a track, and whether it deletes it from your library or cloud or whatever. These things should be really clear. But I do understand why they're trying to get everyone on board to Windows 10. Here's my question. Has anyone come up with an app that you run on Windows 7 or I guess Windows 8, although I don't know anybody who would want Windows 8, not Windows 10, that will, you know, disable this sort of update?
I have it for you, and it was created by our very own Steve Gibson, who hosts Security Now. He is a staunch Windows 7 user. He's called Windows 10 a flying turd. He does not want to upgrade to it. Now, Never 10 is the name of his program. The good news about this is he's doing it the right way. Microsoft did publish instructions, mostly aimed at enterprise, at an IT pro who wants to keep all of her machines at Windows 7 or Windows 8.1. So Microsoft said, well, yeah, you can do it with group policy edit, or you can modify these registry keys. But, of course, no normal user has access to group policy edit or wants to modify their registry. So Steve does it for you. This is a small assembly language program, about 80K. It also has a button to remove, because one of the other things Microsoft does is download 3 gigabytes of worth of Windows installer and then expand it to 8 gigabytes on your hard drive before it even does this. So many of you sitting and watching this may already have 8 gigabytes of your hard drive used up by Windows 10 installer files. So he has a button to remove those as well. And as long as Microsoft doesn't change their policy, which I think they won't, because it would really hurt their reputation in enterprise, this will always work. And you can delete it. Once you do it, you change the registry and it's done, and you can delete the program. So Never 10, if you Google it, it comes right up. It's very popular.
Nice.
So there is a way to stop it, but probably known mostly to people who watch Twit. Another good reason to watch our shows. I think I did you a disservice, because I instead of just showing this dialogue and saying, isn't this terrible, I kind of justified it, and I think I successfully justified it. But I don't think the average user is going to look at that and say, oh, no, I don't want that. I think the average user is going to say, well, I'm going to click that X because I don't want that to happen, and it doesn't fix anything. There's only one way to stop it, and that's to click here. That's a smaller typeface than the other stuff.
It is. They're totally nudging you to, like, letting it go. Yeah. And they're kind of lying to you with the click.
Yeah. It's deceptive. But, you have a good point, Stacey. It's where we're headed.
I'm not saying that I like this. I'm just saying that it's going to happen.
By the way, Microsoft, according to the register, says, that's exactly – Leo's interpretation is right. They didn't say my name, but that's exactly – what we intended. And we're not going to change it. And we don't even think it's deceptive.
I would argue on the last point. But basically, yeah. That's a screw you, you guys.
Yeah. They emailed the register to say, hey, that's how the UI of our, get this, the UI of our, quote, your upgrade is scheduled, end quote, notification is nothing new, including the ability to just X out of the notification with no further action needed to schedule your upgrade.
Yeah.
It's been part of the notification UI for months. Based on customer feedback, we confirm the time of your scheduled upgrade and provide you an opportunity for canceling or rescheduling. That's what customers said. And that's the way it's going to be. So there you go. I don't use Windows.
I'm such a sheep that I always upgrade when Apple
tells
me to upgrade.
You're different. Apple people, see, this is why people say, well, Apple does the same thing. Apple doesn't do the same thing, but
they don't
have to, because everybody who runs Macs wants the update.
Yeah,
I never update.
What?
I update eventually, but I always wait to see what, because everything breaks on an update. Oh, you're right. Wait like 2 or 3 weeks,
I even beta test them now, though. I'm at that
you're
point.
Just,
where
you're just, I'll, yeah.
Yeah.
You're I don't beta test.
No, in fact, iOS 9.3 point, what was it? The most recent update bricked some proportion of
iOS 9.3.2. Yeah, that updated. Yeah, I mean, I run iOS beta on one device just for testing, but I mean, for one of my Macs, I always run like the beta version of OS 10, and that I actually haven't had any problems with. And in fairness, I mean, you know, OS 10 is pretty done at this point. It's pretty stable. So it's not like, you know, they're making huge fundamental changes to it the way that Windows is. So there aren't as many things to potentially break when you get an update from, you know, 10.11 to 10.12 or whatever.
Although I found a Forbes writer who every time there's a new iteration of iOS, he writes a headline about there's a nasty surprise in iOS 9.04. And there were like a dozen of these headlines. He did it every time.
I know that writer is, and he's widely reviled in Apple circles. they're on to him. We're going to take a break. When we come back, our last story, an argument why VR will never succeed. But first, if you missed anything this week, you missed a bunch of stuff. We got a little mini movie to show you some of the highlights. Take a look.
Previously on Twitch.
Get them boots and get them messages.
Twit live specials.
Are you a maker? An inventor? A tinkerer? An engineer? Or an artist? If so, I've got just the place for you. I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, welcoming you to Maker Faire 2016, San Mateo.
Windows Weekly.
These Get Windows 10 advertisements, this weird stuff that Microsoft's doing to try to literally fool people into upgrading to Windows 10 by mistake is the wrong way to treat customers.
We also have to acknowledge there's plenty of people who have perfectly good reasons for not upgrading. They should not be tricked or forced into it.
They should bring back Clippy. That Clippy could say, hey, it looks like you're trying to upgrade to Windows 10. Do you want me to get that thing going for you? And you can be like, no. And then he'll say, okay, let's install Windows 10.
Tech News Today.
So it's time for a double dose of, hey, we're investing in ride-sharing companies too. Toyota struck a pretty important strategic partnership in Uber, allowing drivers to lease Toyota vehicles and not to be left out. Volkswagen announced that it has invested $300 million into Gett.
This feels to me like the weeks leading up to the senior prom where everyone's like, you know, you're fine. You'll do. Like, let's pair up. Like, just
you'll do. You're better than nobody, I guess.
Twit, we love you.
We do. We really do. Going to be a big week ahead. Jason Howell, what's happening?
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here is a look at a few things we're going to be keeping a close eye on in the week ahead. First off, Computex actually kicks off in Taipei. You know, usually see some interesting kind of Windows 10 developments, devices, also some Android devices there. So I'm sure we'll see a couple of devices rolling out. Also, Augmented World Expo happens starting Wednesday, June 1st. This is the world's largest AR and VR expo. Man, I wish I could go there and check out some of this stuff. We're actually going to have a team there to cover the event. So someone's going there, and we'll have lots of coverage for you next week. Developers building Apple WatchOS apps should mark June 1st on their calendar. That's the day that Apple requires that watch apps be native apps, meaning that they can be untethered to a device. So if you're developing watch apps, definitely want to look out for that. Also on June 1st, June 1st is a big day. Comcast opens up its data cap from 300 gigs to 1 terabyte of data. That might save you if you're thinking about getting an unlimited plan or whatever. Comcast is opening it up, and that's a good deal. Check out Tech News Today. We record every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. Myself and Megan Maroney, we're on set talking about all these stories and a whole lot more. So you should definitely check it out at twit.tv/live. That's it for the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Jason Howell. Monday through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, as he said, 7 p.m. Eastern. Tech News Today. Our show today brought to you by our Ring Video Doorbell. Oh, I love this thing. I love my Ring. I have it on my front door. You have it on your back door. Stacey, who had it on the back door? Was it you, Philip?
It
was you, Stacey.
It is me.
Yeah. I love it because it's a doorbell that connects. It's an Internet of Things device. It connects to your Wi-Fi, replaces your existing doorbell. One of the problems with doorbells, of course, I can never hear it in the house. The chime goes thonk, thonk. So this replaces it. And not only does the chime still ring, but your phone or your tablet or everything rings. They've got Ring apps for iOS, for Android. They even have a Ring app now for the Macintosh. And so you'll never miss somebody at their doorbell, even if you're not at home, because it is attached to the Internet. So you hear the phone ring. I hear it here at work. Then, of course, it's got a wide-angle HD camera on it, microphone and speaker, too. You can talk to who's at your door. You could say, oh, sorry, I'm in the shower, so don't break into my house, bad guy. Which, by the way, it happens a lot. They tend to come during, apparently, I didn't know this, but the stats say they come, about 95% of burglaries come during the day. The bad guy comes to the door, knocks on the door, rings the doorbell. You don't answer, goes around the back and breaks in. Well, now you've got crystal clear video of the bad guy, and you can tell him, go away, I'm inside, even if you're not. The Ring Video Doorbell, it's easy to install, and I installed it myself. Looks great. They have a variety of finishes. Go to ring.com and get free FedEx shipping on the original Ring Video Doorbell at ring.com/twit. This is just a great idea, and I feel like it'd be great not only for you but for family members, maybe your parents or whoever. Give them a little sense of security. ring.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of our show. Great panel today from Mashable. Christina Warren, always wonderful to have Film Girl on the show. From Stacy on IoT and the IoT podcast, Stacy Higginbotham, IoTpodcast.com. Giga Stacy on the Twitter. And, of course, Philip Elmer DeWitt, PED at PED30.com. Last story, Steve Baker writing in Quora. Now, Steve Baker is a designer of simulation of aircraft simulators, flight simulators for pilots. He's been doing that for over 25 years. And he says, forget about it. There's no way VR is ever going to work. Not these devices have been around forever. He says, I've been using them for years and years and years. And the problem isn't, latency. It's not screen resolution, all the things that the companies like Oculus and Vive say it is. The problem is depth perception. See, and he says the problem is that your eyes are converging really close, but the objects you're looking at are sometimes distant. You have a disconnect in your caveman brain. He says, what happens when the convergence system says an object is 2 meters away and the focusing system says it's 6 meters away? Well, according to our caveman evolved brain, we're hallucinating. We must have eaten something terrible. Throw it up. Your brain goes into panic mode, tries to empty this substance. Now, he says this is going to happen. People will always get sick with VR displays unless the content is further than around 3 meters from them. And, of course, that excludes any kind of application that happens inside a building, because the floor is always less than 3 meters away from you unless you're 9-foot-tall alien. And he quotes not just his own thesis, but the United States Navy and the U.S. Army, both of which did extensive studies on sim sickness, and it's even worse than you might imagine, even without nausea, and maybe not everybody gets sick, but there's a measurable degree of confusion and disorientation after prolonged exposure to VR experiences. The U.S. military advises against flying a plane or even driving a car for 24 hours after being inside a simulator. Quote, one question still not answered is the actual time course of the symptoms experienced by the aviators in the simulator and the recurrence of delayed effects. Anecdotal data continues to be received indicating that there is a part of the aviation population that experiences delayed problems beyond the simulator exposure and for periods that exceed 6 to 8 hours. That's approximately 8% of the population, and for a smaller group, 1 to 2 days. Studies should be conducted to determine which scenarios are linked with simulator sickness and methods to prepare aviators to deal with these scenarios. But you shouldn't be driving a car, let alone piloting an aircraft. So Baker points out, look, we're going to put a lot of these devices in people's hands, not just the Oculus and the Vive, but also the PlayStation VR, which is due out. I love them. He says, but if you go to the labs where they're making, these guys don't wear them for very long. They know. And we're going to have all sorts of problems of people driving under the influence of VR. What do you think? I have to say, Christine, I bet you've played a lot with these. What's the longest you've spent?
I don't know, maybe like an hour and a half.
And when you took it off, were you disoriented? Was life
a little bit?
Yeah,
a little bit, but I didn't feel drunk. I mean, look, I don't drive again, so I kind of feel safe.
You're safe in the subway, yeah.
I'm safe in the subway, yeah. But I mean, a little bit. I have to say, over time, it's gotten a lot better. I mean, I've seen huge improvements just from like the original like DK2 Oculus to the shipped version, and the Vive, I think, is a good experience too. So I understand the concerns, and I think they're really valid. But I always feel weird about any prognostications that like that this is an unsolvable problem, because I feel like technology moves so quickly and we've thought this about other things in the past, and then it turns out there are solutions. But I do think it's a valid concern, and I do think it's one of those things that we do have to consider as VR becomes a bigger and bigger deal. And I think that this is one of the things why there are so many people are hesitant about VR, right? Because it's not just nausea, but it's depth of perception, it's other things. The general consensus is not that this is going to necessarily be the next big thing. It's kind of a toss up between, is this 3D TV or is this, you know, smartphones? I don't really know the answer of what it's going to be yet, but I definitely think that what he wrote raises a lot of interesting questions, and are definitely things that I'm sure everybody at all these companies, I'm sure they're thinking about these issues and are investing in heavy research and development to solve these sorts of problems too.
He says we've had 20 years. We've known about this forever.
Well, I mean, that's fair. But at the same time, I mean, they've had 20 years, and yet it was, you know, a kid who kind of helped kind of come up with like kind of the modern implementation of things.
Yeah, but the modern implementation, the big story there is really not that he improved VR, but he got the price down. Because I remember 30 years ago getting in a VR, you know, rig and riding a pterodactyl at SIGGRAPH 92. And it was exactly the same experience. In fact, probably, arguably, he says, a better experience, lower latency, higher resolution displays, more accurate head tracking. The big advance of Palmer Luckey and the rest is they got the price down, because it used to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars.
It's true.
I get sick every time I'm in VR. So does my wife. I wish I didn't. I'm like, everyone's like, this is the way to be. And I'm like, after about 5 minutes, and everyone's like, it'll go away over time. But so far it hasn't.
Yeah.
So I feel like if this is the next big thing, I feel kind of screwed.
What the industry tells us is, no, we're getting the latency down between turning the head and the picture moving, and that's going to fix it. I don't think it does. Now, he points out that Cardboard, Google's VR, doesn't have that problem as much, because they mostly use applications where you're not moving. You're just turning your head around.
Right. That makes sense.
I also should point out that people said that 3D movies and TV would die for a similar reason, that your eyes are converging on one distance, your focal point is a different distance. So the theater screen is 60 feet away, but you see a twig 3 feet away, and your brain is saying you can't converge at one distance and focus at another distance. Throw up. You're hallucinating. I find this fascinating, and it's a big story because, frankly, this is going to be a multi-billion dollar industry, and if it makes people nauseous or worse, causes car accidents, we've got a problem.
Maybe it'll be a $30 billion. I mean, it's not the smartphone. And just because the smartphone is so huge, I mean, to be able to put the internet in your pocket, is that's a hard thing to match for any technology. Well, my only experience is with the cardboard and showing the cardboard to people. And what's so cool is you show them this, and it's really cheap technology, and it's like the scales have fallen off their eyes. And they say, wow, this is amazing.
I agree.
But then they don't. You know, then what's next? And I can see it for gamers. That's definitely a market. And I can see it for porn, and maybe for training airplane pilots. But, you know, how big is that?
Yeah.
So like the internet, so the smartphone put the internet in your pocket, right? The idea behind VR and why everyone wants to spend so much money on it is because you conceivably could put the world in your pocket. Not today.
Right.
It's more like the PC, but I mean, if your biggest problem is, you know, the internet changed distribution models, you know, sending digital bits around, VR is a way to kind of turn atoms into bits in some way. Not exactly.
You can't put
you there.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
Yeah.
But agree. Yeah, I still get sick.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think some percentage of people will always get sick.
No, I can't be one of those. I'll be left behind.
No, I don't think you have to feel bad about it. I don't think you have to feel bad about it. Lisa gets sick. She can't do it. I'll be looking at stuff and say, oh, this is so cool. You got to try it. She puts it on. She goes, oh. Because you guys have a better evolved system to prevent eating magic mushrooms than we do.
I feel like I could do that just fine. But.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. It was an interesting article. I found it thought provoking. It was on Quora. You know, which is a strange place to find something like that. But I thought that was quite interesting. Folks, we've run out of time, but we have had a blast, and I'm so glad that you all were here. I thank you, Stacy. I'm looking forward to seeing a lot more of you on Twig. We're thrilled to have you as part of the team. You can find Stacy's podcast at the IoT. What is it? IoTpodcast.com. I don't want to say the IoTpodcast.com. That's the show she does. With Kevin Toefel. Kevin's a regular, right?
Yeah, Kevin's on every week.
Yeah. You're already up to episode 60, which is nice. Very nice.
Forever.
And, of course, you can read about her IoT stuff at Stacy. Is it Stacy on IoT?
Yes. That's the newsletter. It's weekly.
Oh, that's a newsletter. And where do we get that?
You go to stacyonIoT.com to sign up. I don't have a web place yet because I haven't figured out my strategy there. I know.
Well, I will follow you anywhere. Sign up for it. It's free. stacyonIoT.com. And Philip Elmer DeWitt, leaving his cushy job to start his own thing. And God bless you for doing it. I think it's a great idea. PED30.com. And anything, you know, what are you working on?
Oh, you know, the news never ends with Apple. Let me just say about the website, it's $10 a month or $100 a year. But if you don't want to pay, wait 3 days and the paywall lifts and it's all free.
That's a clever way to do it.
Yeah, if you're behind a paywall, you sort of become invisible on the internet. So this is my way around it.
Yeah. I look at people like Ben Thompson and Harsh Dedeu and see, and I really feel like there is an opportunity for somebody who's smart and has a unique voice to do just fine in a situation like this. Jason Snell, absolutely. When are we going to get you out of your day job, Christina Warren, at Mashable.com?
I think about it.
Oh, but you've got such a good job.
I do have a good job. So yeah. So it's but it is always one of those things. Especially we talk to people like Stacy and Philip who are kind of doing it and looking at what Jason's done. It's always one of those things. You think, could I? I don't know. But
it's always tempting. But you know what? Let me tell you, and I'm sure that Stacy and Philip will agree. There are also some serious challenges, and it's a little scary, frankly. You know, and if things are going well, no reason to. You know, here's the thing. Don't tell Cashmore this. But the truth is, and people do this to me too, you're using his platform to build your brand.
Totally.
And just continue to do so. And at some point, your brand is big enough that you can, you know, you're building up steam. You're going down that runway. send any moment now, you could lift off. You know, just get that brand to the point where you lift off. That's all. Use me. Use me too. We love having you on. We'll see a lot more of you, I know. Christina Warren, thank you.
Thanks.
We do Twit every Sunday, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2200 UTC. If you want to join us live, want to be in the audience, email tickets at twit.tv. We'd love to see you. If you can't be here in person or on the tubes, the inner tubes, or in the chat room at irc.twit.tv, we do have on-demand audio and video of every show we do at our website, twit.tv. Or you can use your podcast app of choice and subscribe and make sure you get every episode, audio or video. We don't care as long as you join us every week. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing. In the can.
Bye-bye.
Yay.
Doing the Twit.